This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 10th, 2015. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Thank you all for joining us today. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Tuesday, November 10th, 2015 will come to order. And I do want to apologize to everyone who's waiting for the late start, but we had some discussions that we had to complete prior to the meeting, so please, we're sorry. There are some late submitted documents. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the following. Agenda documents 15-57C, 15-57D, 15-57E, 15-62A, 15-61A, 15-60A, 15-63A, and 15-57F.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has so moved. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Madam Secretary, that matter passes unanimously. Okay. The first item, item number one, is Draft Advisory Opinion 2015-9, Senate Majority PAC and House Majority PAC. Today we have Nevin Stepanovic from OGC and Amy Rothstein in the back there here to discuss the matter. We also have, please come forward, thank you. Even without a tie, you can come forward.
Apologize.
No problem.
I have one in my office if you'd like one.
Yeah.
That'd be a true moment of bipartisanship.
Right. Mark Elias, Jonathan Burkhan, Rachel Jacobs, and I believe Ezra Reese is in the back. Thank you. And these are requesters counsel who are here. Mr. Stepanovic.
Thank you, and good morning, commissioners. This advisory opinion request was held over from the last open session. And since then, the commission released several new draft advisory opinions labeled as agenda documents 15-57-C, D, E, and F. The commission also received three comments since the last open session. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Where to start? Are there any questions for counsel, perhaps, or do we want to just begin the discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not questions for counsel, but I did have, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the individual answers, I did have a couple of sort of overarching comments that I wanted to make. I want to say, first of all, that I have sympathy both for the requester who has been expressing some frustration at the prospect that perhaps he won't get answers to his questions. And I think we're going to try. Probably won't be able to answer all of them. And also for those commenters who expressed frustration that, you know, drafts came out late and they didn't feel that they had adequate time to comment. I think that what this emphasizes is that these are important issues that are in front of us, and as I've said before, I think we really should have addressed these issues long ago through a rulemaking, and that would have given everybody adequate time to comment. It would have given us the opportunity to have a hearing. I also suggested to my colleagues that perhaps this might be a good case to at least try out a proposal that the chair and I made earlier this year, that we ought to invite people besides just the requester to engage with us at meetings where we're discussing advisory opinions. I know there's at least three lawyers in the audience today from outside the building who are probably interested in this, and several people who commented in writing. You know, Mr. Spies commented, Mr. Backer commented. I suspect that they might have a different perspective than Mr. Elias, and that our debate would be informed by having them here to talk to us. And I think it is unfortunate that nobody was interested in doing that, but I think it would have been helpful and would have served the purpose that some of the commenters raised of getting more public engagement on these important issues. In the last week, I've heard one Republican lawyer describe this agency as an epic failure. Publicly, and I've heard from another lawyer privately that his impression is that lawyers all over town are giving different advice to their clients, that, you know, some people are taking more aggressive stances towards the law and other people are taking more conservative approaches to the law. And I know that from my experience as a lawyer and from what people continue to tell me, that one of the questions that clients ask is, what's going to happen to me if I don't do what you're telling me, even when they do get good advice from their lawyers? I think that Mr. Elias has presented us with an opportunity to defy expectations and actually provide some meaningful guidance and perhaps set some boundaries and make the rules clear to everybody so that everybody's playing from the same playbook and every candidate is following the same set of rules. And I think that I wish that we would fully rise to the occasion. I think that we will probably partially rise to the occasion, answer some of the easier questions. But I wanted to also point out that even in areas where we may not end up agreeing, there are the seeds for perhaps later agreements. I was, to take one example, and I don't want to at this point go through every single of the 12 questions, but I noted that in Draft C, which some commissioners support, not me, in response to one of the questions, the answer says, an individual's active participation in the formation and operation of the contemplated single candidate committees, the sole purpose of which is to support that individual's federal candidacy, or in the filming of video intended to be used to promote that individual's federal candidacy, could evidence the making of a decision to seek nomination for election or election to a federal office. Now, some of us who support a different draft think that it definitely would, and other commissioners appear to think that it could. And the premise of several of the answers in Draft C appears to be that we are assuming for the purposes of this answer, they seem to think this was baked into the request, and I'm not sure that it actually was, that we know that this individual has not already decided to run for office, that this individual is still up in the air as to whether they are going to declare their candidacy. And several of the answers in Draft C are premised on that assumption, which, as I said, I'm not sure that was intended to be baked into the question, but that seems to be the way the answer is written. But that actually gives me some hope that down the road, as we are dealing with individual fact patterns, that there could be grounds for consensus, because there seems to be more consensus that might be indicated in draft F, I guess. It was the last draft we issued. That there is some consensus about what factors could be relevant. You know, perhaps we're not viewed as decisive in response to this question that's in front of us, but could be relevant in other circumstances. And I think that I would assume that when we're looking at these fact-specific analyses of who's a candidate and when they become a candidate, that these factors have got to be cumulative. So the questions were asked individually. What if the individual does this? Does that trigger candidacy? And what if they do that? Does that trigger candidacy? But if we were presented with a fact pattern where somebody did a lot of those things all together, I think that might be yet a different answer, because there is a cumulative effect of a series of activities and conduct that an individual engages in that could make it clear to perhaps even a majority of commissioners that somebody has made their decision and is indeed determined to run for office. So even to the extent that we are not, I think we may not be able to answer the question as fully as I would hope today, at least not with the majority of commissioners behind it, behind every answer, I think that there are seeds for agreement. You know, it doesn't mean it will happen, but I prefer to remain optimistic that we could, going forward, find some common ground on how to approach these problems. So that's just sort of my overall
thank you.
Take.
Any other comments? Commissioner Hunter.
Yes, I have a question for the requester, but briefly just responding to some of what Commissioner Weintraub said. You know, I bet we cannot think of a moment in time since this agency was established where some lawyers are out there complaining that different lawyers are interpreting things differently. I remember that was the case when I worked at the Republican National Committee. I've worked there all three times. There were different issues where you call one lawyer and he says one thing, you call another, he says another, he or she. And so I think that's a common refrain. I'm not too worried about that, and that's always going to be a complaint. Another one is the rule that you referenced both in the last meeting and today that you wanted to pass a few years ago. My recollection, I could be wrong, but my recollection is that it did not address the questions that Mr. Elias is asking today. So even if we had done that, I don't recall that there was anything in there about pre-candidacy and testing the waters and some of the things that are coming up now. So no matter what we do, you know, we're never going to be able to answer every permutation, everything that creative lawyers who want to participate in the political process come up with, and that doesn't bother me. With respect to the request before us today, Mr. Elias, you point out in your comment that you may have some consensus on questions 11 and 12 because both draft A and draft C answer those questions and say that the conduct is okay. And I wanted to ask you if you have any comment on that. I'm not sure how lines up. I know that I would be willing to support questions 11 and 12 in draft C and A. They're the same. So do you have any comments on those issues?
Yeah, so at the risk of guessing where drafts came from, I assume, and by the way, I tweeted about this last night, so a number of you have undoubtedly interacted with me. You can, the public can know that. That's fine. I've been very vocal about my view of this for anyone who's followed me on Twitter, at least, which maybe is less vocal than I'd like. If I am correct, draft C, I assume, enjoys at least the support of one or more Republican commissioners, and draft A originated, I assume, and enjoyed and became part of the public record because one or more Democratic commissioners supported it. I think that therefore there should be a basis for compromise on the votes. On the merits, I want to say that in some respects, 11 and 12 were put in. They are in some respects they're very, very important functional questions that campaign finance lawyers need answered. They are also less. It would seem that they play more closely to the statutory, regulatory, and past guidance of the commission. I am not sure how you get to know on 11 without fundamentally undoing the guidance that this agency has given regarding agency. I have looked at it over the last week, and I just don't see how you get there. This commission told, in a bipartisan vote, in fact, it may have been 6-0, that a Republican chief of staff for a sitting House member, okay, an employee of a House member could raise soft money for a state party. And let us be honest, we can dress up and put all kinds of lipstick on the idea that state parties operate for a myriad of purposes. When you are the Republican Party chair in Montana, they only have one House seat. And he was the chair of the party and the chief of staff for that House member. So I think the commission got it right there, by the way. So this is not a criticism. But the idea that somehow the law evolved involving super PACs, doesn't enjoy any statutory support, doesn't enjoy any regulatory support, and I am not sure what the commission will have done if it unwinds what seems to me to be relatively well-settled guidance about wearing multiple hats. I came in to this commission on behalf of Rory Reid and the Nevada Democratic Party in connection with Senator Harry Reid. Campaign and the FEC established the multiple hats theory. Again, it was not hidden from this commission that Senator Reid was a candidate for Senate in cycle, and the Nevada Democratic Party was going to be doing activity that was going to be seen as directly benefiting the Senate campaign. Again, consistent with the FEC's regulations around federal election activity and the allocation of funds and all. But I to me, 11 is, in some sense, the easiest question I asked, because all it does is reaffirm a principle that the commission has now affirmed in any number of AOs. The Corzine AO, it affirmed it in the.
Which one was that? Sorry.
The Corzine, where John Corzine was a U.S. senator running for governor. And the question was whether he could, whether he or his staff could raise soft money for his gubernatorial campaign, not for the campaign itself, but for attendant party organizations and county groups, which are not FEC committees, by the way, in New Jersey in most instances. And the FEC, again, trotted out multiple hats and said, well, you know, John Corzine can't wear a multiple hat, but these other people around him, if they're doing it on behalf of the county party committee or on behalf of these local groups, they can wear multiple hats. So I 11 to me, like I said, seems like it is just a logical reaffirmance of where the commission has been. On 12, I have scoured in probably, there are probably few issues that we have looked at as intensely as this question of what is an event. The history of this event exception, as you know, is somewhat long and complicated because it began with an FEC rule that limited it solely to state parties. Then there was a lawsuit challenge, and then in a bipartisan moment, the commission unanimously extended it to all groups, not just state parties, in exchange for some other things about what could happen at the event. Obviously, that allowance extends to super PACs. I don't think that's an issue even in any of the answers to 12. So the question is, what is an event? And we have looked at every possible place to find guidance from the FEC or other agencies that defines an event, and we've been unable to. So in the request, we made a point of not saying, okay, this is just going to be two people sitting in a room. They're going to walk in and hold an event. We lay out specifically what we think are reasonable criteria for an event, which is that there will be sent an invitation. The invitation will list the Senate or House candidate as special guest and contain proper disclaimers. It'll include a date certain and a time certain when the event will be held. There will be a program for the event, including formal remarks. They will not disseminate publicity for the event, or the Senate candidate or House candidate won't disseminate publicity for the event or otherwise extend invitations for the event. We are asking about something that is a genuine event, and we are simply asking whether there is a threshold of numerosity for that. I think unquestionably, if you issue invitations, having a date, event certain, have the disclaimers, have formal remarks, we're describing an event. And our only question is, does number matter? And I think draft A gets it right on the law, which is that there is nothing in the FEC's precedent, there is nothing in the statute, there is nothing in the legislative history, there is nothing in the regulatory history. I mean, we have looked at all these, and I was eager to see if anyone else found it. There is nothing that suggests that numerosity is a criteria. And again, it seems like that is a relatively easy place to draw a line. And I think for people who are worried about creep in this area, look at the other criteria we have lined up here. Look at the other things that we have said we will do, and ask yourself, isn't that really the safeguard for abuse that you may or may not be concerned about? So to me, I think you're right Commissioner Weingart, I think you're right. The commission has an opportunity here. The commission has an opportunity to. This is an audience full of skeptics that the FEC is going to agree on anything that involves super PACs. And much of what is in draft F is our answers that are saying that people can't do stuff. Okay, so in some sense, if you were to divide, and I won't say on partisan grounds, but if you were to divide between the more permissive and less permissive, the less permissive among you are get something out of draft F. And it seems to me that a reasonable balance to that, or a reasonable accommodation to that, is to add draft A's answer, draft A and C's answer, to 11 and 12. Be able to tell the public you agreed on 6 questions of 12 in one of the most hotly contested areas of the law would be a great message for the commission. I also think, by the way, 11 and 12 it has the benefit of also being the right answer. But I would encourage folks to the commissioners to, you know, to work towards finding a solution for 11 and 12. So that's a long answer.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, let me respond to that, since neither draft A or draft C are my drafts, and I don't think I'm disclosing any secret in saying that draft A was the original draft that the staff gave us. That was their recommendation. The general counsel, yeah. The one that I would support is draft E. So let me address 11 and 12 in draft E.
I apologize. I've got a lot of
drafts. I know.
I just want to be able to follow along.
And as I tweeted at you last night, if you thought 6 was the maximum number of answers we could have come up with, if 6 commissioners could have come up with in response to 12 questions, you underestimate our creativity.
I've been asked I was asked this morning if the FEC has ever had more than 6 drafts for an AO. I don't believe so.
I don't know. But you might know, since you are a heavy user of our advisory opinion process. Let me just mention that I was recused from several, if not all, of the AOs that you cited to earlier. So I know they weren't, I don't know whether that makes it unanimous or not if somebody's recused, but everybody else agrees. But in any event, it wasn't with my participation. I think that with respect to the question 11, the agency question, I don't think that the FEC has ever squarely addressed the situation where somebody is an authorized agent and fundraiser for a candidate and at the same time claims to switch hats and go out and raise money for that same candidate, for that very same candidate, for a group that is indisputably going to spend that money to benefit that candidate. And be raising hard money here and soft money there. And I'm not convinced that just in the real world that scenario works. I think that everybody will understand that the candidate's agent is indeed, when they are raising funds to benefit that candidate, they are acting as that candidate's agent. You can agree with me or disagree with me on that, but I think factually that's the way people would see that situation, and that is what underlies the answer to question 11. And indeed, it's been one of my frustrations for quite a long time that, that fact pattern was not part of the majority PAC AO that you submitted. I think it was majority PAC and not Common Sense 10 in that iteration, asking about whether candidates and office holders could solicit hard money for super PACs. But nothing in that AO suggested that those super PACs were going to be spending that money on behalf of those same candidates. So I think it was an open question there and remains an open question, and I would answer it the other way. Come on, Mr. Elias, you had a long time to talk about your views of 11 and 12. On 12, I actually feel even stronger. The commission went down that road of revising its solicitation rules in response to BCRA and initially distinguished state party events, and I personally think we should have stuck with that distinction. Because there's that special carve-out in the statute that says that candidates and office holders can appear, speak, or be featured guests at state party events. And we know where that came from. That came from the desire of... that came from the desire of members of Congress not to be excluded from their Lincoln Day or Jefferson Jackson Day events. They wanted to be able to go back to their home state and mingle with the grassroots activists and show up at these events, which are almost always crowd events, and wave to the crowd and see and be seen and make comments and address them. And they didn't want to be excluded from that, regardless of whether they were soft money that was going to be raised in that event. But that whole scenario, even if it wasn't explicitly laid out in the statute of the regulation, suggests a group event, a crowd event. The kinds of concerns that animate contribution limits and that the Supreme Court has recognized as far back as the Buckley decision, go to the inherent risk. That's what the Supreme Court said. There's an inherent risk of corruption when members are soliciting unlimited amounts of money, when candidates and office holders are soliciting unlimited amounts of money, and that goes to their agents as well. And I think that is nowhere more present than in a small backroom meeting with, you know, a couple of people there. In this day and age, it could be a billionaire donor who has the resources to put millions of dollars behind a super PAC, and a candidate or office holder, and then one other person, perhaps, who would be the representative of the super PAC. So, you know, I'm trying to envision how this would even work in such a small group setting. How does one make formal remarks when there are three people in the room? Does that mean I stand up and say, "Now, Mr. Elias, I'm going to make my formal remarks to you"?
You have to get an invitation first.
I have to get an invitation first. That's true. The regulations that we put out talked about things like publicity for the event and putting placards at the door, and we're just sort of infused with this notion that this was a group event. And I think that we run a very big risk if we say that it's okay to, in settings of two or three or four people, to pretend that this is a fundraising event as opposed to a private meeting with a prospective very large donor. Now, I hear your concern that it would be nice to have a bright line rule so that you would know. And I don't know that we can pick a number in the context of an advisory opinion, but I will offer you an analogy from an area of law that you and I are both well familiar with. In another context where members of Congress were concerned about improper influence in private dinners in the devising of the gift rules in the House and the Senate, they devised an exception for what they called widely attended events, and the floor on that is 25 people. So there is at least another context in which, you know, if you want to look for an analogy somewhere in the world, where members of Congress have deemed an event to be something that has at least 25 bodies in the room, or at least a reasonable expectation of 25 bodies in the room. You know, I can't tell you right now that, you know, that's going to be, we're just going to adopt that rule, because I don't think we can do that in the advisory opinion context. But I do think that that is a place that one could look to for an analogy, perhaps some sort of unofficial safe harbor of, you know, that at least has been recognized by members of Congress as event worthy to have 25 people in the room. And I think that when you have 25 people in the room, it is a very different feel and much more event-like than if you have two or three or four people in the room. So I know you're not going to agree with me on that, but And as I said, I think we could do a rulemaking, and maybe if we did do a rulemaking, we would come up with a different number. Maybe we'd say 20 people. Maybe we'd, you know, maybe people would come in and say, let us tell you how fundraising events work and how common it is to have 10 people in the room at a real fundraising event, and I might be persuaded by that, but, you know, outside of the rulemaking context, I think the best I can do is to try to stay true to the animating concerns behind the anti-corruption principles that underlie the Act, and to offer you the best analogy that I could come up with. Mr. Elias.
If I can just respond to a couple of things, I realize I'm not going to convince you, but I just want the record to be clear. The first is, with respect to the agency, you said that it will look like that they are fundraising for the candidate if they have multiple hats. The FEC considered apparent authority and rejected it. And this is why I keep speaking to this side of the dais. If you are saying the agency rules don't apply as they are written, don't assume that people are going to mean that that means that we go more restrictive. Because if the agency rules don't apply, if we go to what does it look like, and it's not now, it's no longer actual authority, it's in your mind it's apparent authority, I am sure in their mind it's express authority. And then we're back having that debate again. And so I don't see how under the rules you get to, under the rules as they are, you get to a no on 11. I understand under apparent authority how you get there. But apparent authority was rejected by this commission along with express authority. We wound up in this middle.
But there's still implied authority.
Yes, but not, but you said what it will look like. And that's apparent authority. And that's what was rejected by the commission, number one. Number two is we are not talking about candidates doing this. Candidates are always agents of themselves. I actually sought an advisory opinion asking whether John Corzine, same one, whether John Corzine could in some cases wear multiple hats and not be a U.S. senator. Could he wear multiple hats and be just a gubernatorial candidate? And I was told no, that the candidate is always the candidate. So we're not talking about circumstances in which a Senate candidate is going to say that they themselves could take advantage of multiple hats. We're talking about the myriad of circumstances, which is what the FEC dealt with, where you hold a fundraiser in your house for a congressional candidate, and at the same time, you are unbeknownst to the candidate, or maybe unbeknownst to the candidate, but likely unbeknownst to the candidate, also raising money for a super PAC. Honestly, that happens probably thousands of times a day, or thousands of times into this world, whether good or bad, thousands of times a month. And I frankly simply don't see the basis to argue that the chief of staff for the congressman who's sitting in his official office and doing his business 24/7 as his chief of staff somehow wears two hats, and yet the lay fundraiser who is, you know, sometimes raising money for a super PAC, sometimes may hold one event or solicit three checks from their friends for the campaign, somehow can't wear multiple hats. I think 11 is just flat out wrong on the law. I think it would be a departure from existing FEC precedent. I guess the best I could say is that it would be such a stark departure from existing FEC precedent that unless it commanded four votes, we would just revert back to existing FEC precedent, which would be terrible. It would be a bad thing for the commission. Frankly, for a commission that's trying to establish itself as rule-bound, as opposed to just, I feel this way and I feel that way, and then let's deadlock because we don't get anything done. So I find 11 to just be inscrutable, how 11 could be no. On 12, you say, I understand your, I wanted to again make just, I realize I'm not going to persuade you, but two things. Number one, you said soliciting. The theory of the event exception is that the candidate's not soliciting. So there is no solicitation by the candidate. So we don't have to worry about, right? The whole reason why Congress created the exemption for 10 speaker or featured guest was that the candidate was attending, speaking, or was a featured guest, but was in fact not soliciting. So we actually don't have to worry about the corruption rationale that you lay out, because in fact, Congress has told us that where they're just attending, speaking, or being the featured guest, the fact that there may be a $5 million price tag. Right, so the Virginia Republican Party holds an event, JJ dinner, or in your hypothetical, 25 people, And a federal candidate, without Eric Cantor left, I'm not sure who to pick.
Bob Goodlatte.
Bob Goodlatte is the featured guest at that event. The reason why, and it says on the invitation, ticket price $5 million, corporate money only. And please have interest before the U.S. Congress. Okay, that's permissible under the campaign finance laws precisely because the theory of the statute and the courts, which, as you know, it played a role in this, and the agency, is that in that instance, Bob Goodlatte is not soliciting. He's just attending the event. And so we have said we would abide by the rules that the candidates would not make themselves a solicitation or make a federal solicitation. So I think that it's not true that this is a solicitation. I think it's important to keep that again, just for purposes of making the record, because who knows where we wind up next, that if your position is that's a solicitation, I think that's a very different thing than what the statute says. Finally, on the widely attended events, we actually looked at this. The fact is, Congress, first of all, there's always an inherent question of whether you can take an ethical rule of Congress and say that it provides analogous guidance to a federal statute. But interestingly, Congress inserted the words widely attended, whereas here they did not. So if you assume that Congress acts purposefully in the language they use, the fact that they did not require these events to be widely attended, I think, is actually quite telling. Because Congress had proved itself able to, where it wanted to include some importance of numerosity, Congress knew how to do that, and in fact had done it with its own rules. Here, Congress chose not to put numerosity into the event exception, which they quite easily could have. They quite have easily said, look, this is an exception to go to big events. And they could very well have used language that empowered the agency to use numerosity as a criteria, but they didn't. So I just wanted to respond to those specific legal points, but I understand, Commissioner, you are not likely to vote for 11 and 12.
Did you want to speak? Commissioner Walter.
I've got questions on maybe for General Counsel, too. But I understand that there's not any number, and you seem to be... It seems to be very important to you to know the number.
Or that there is not a number.
Or that there's not a number.
Right, the simple answer to the question would be no.
In the past, you've not felt that there was a magic number one way or the other, I assume. I have not seen this issue come before us as a big issue before, and where we tied everything to a number. And it seems to me there could be a lot of other factors. It's who's there as opposed to who isn't there,
right,
and how they got there and who got the invitation. And so, I mean, there's a bunch of malleable ways you can approach a gathering, call it this way before we call it an event. But, you look at the state of Nevada, for example, and we don't have big events except for two potential cities. And so I'm not sure that it makes sense if you had 25 as your rule and 24 showed up, then what do you do?
Right.
To me, I'm wondering why you're asking that now.
Well, so, Commissioner, first of all, if there is a compromise to be had here, I would take as an answer to number 12 just the word no. Okay? Because the question we asked is there a minimum number of expected attendees? Is there a minimum expected number of attendees? We only get to that, and I in some ways wish I hadn't done the 2, 3, 4 in the request, because now everyone's latched on to, are you asking for 2? What I'm really asking is numerosity, is there a minimum number? Is numerosity itself a threshold that we have to clear? So if you all can just agree on one word, no, I don't need any of the reasoning. I think the general counsel, now that I know it's your draft, I think their analysis on this point is spot on. But if you don't want to adopt any law on this, just say no. Numerosity doesn't matter. And then in Utah, it'll be different than, you know, because of the other facts and circumstances.
Utah, you got to point to Matt. It's in Nevada here.
To your question of why ask the question, so I have... You know, despite whatever lawyer said, whatever they said that you quoted, I believe that what the FEC does is important, and what you say matters. And where I am asked advice by a client, I try to cabin the advice the best I can to what the law is, what the regulations are, what other guidance is. Yes, I offer judgment about how I think the law is likely to be interpreted, but this question has caused uncertainty for these two super PACs. They are in a world in which they are doing more and more fundraising, they are doing more and more events, and the question of do they have to worry, do they have to cancel an event if a certain number of people don't show up? Do they have to reschedule things? Do they have to take attendance? Is an issue, and it's an issue for them because the world of super PAC fundraising, whether you lament it or you celebrate it, the world of super PAC fundraising is growing, and the question of numerosity is a live one. So, if you can, perhaps Commissioner Weintraub, I can convince you to just say no, and then you can live to fight another day on the facts of things that come before you. But if we can all agree that there is not a threshold number, then the answer to question 12 is just no.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I'll just say briefly the fact that this is a live question, that that people are not confident that the answer is no, despite your eloquent arguments for why the answer should be no, suggests to me that it's not all that clear that the answer has to be no.
So, Commissioner, I've tried to always be clear. I ask questions of the FEC. People will say, why did you ask this question? I ask the question because I need an answer, right? If I knew the answer entirely, it is rare. There have been a handful of times where I've come to the agency because I have a client that just, typically in the corporate sector where they just want that piece of paper.
Yeah.
But I usually come because I think I know the answer. I have to say I have become more bullish that I am right hearing that the general counsel drafted A. Because honestly, the general counsel carries no partisan agenda and certainly has never been accused in this agency, going back to many general counsels before them, of being a deregulatory force in the law. So if the general counsel's office says I'm right on 11 and 12, I actually sleep pretty well at night, thinking that the general counsel and hopefully a majority of the commission, but certainly a substantial number of commissioners agree with me.
No other comments, questions?
I've got a question for my colleagues.
Commissioner Weintraub.
If I could. I know, this is just a point of confusion, actually, and it is on hang on, I've got to find the right question. On draft C. Ah, yes. So draft C on page 16 says, when an individual becomes a candidate, payments for testing the waters activities may be made only with funds permissible under the Act. If that is the only time when the testing the waters act, regulations apply, then they never apply. Page 16, draft C, the top paragraph, the carryover paragraph from the preceding page.
I'm sorry, what? What page?
Page 16, 1-6. This is in response to whether requesters and the single candidate committees can work with individuals to establish separate 527 organizations to pay for testing the waters activities with soft money, despite the fact that the regulations say that you can't pay for testing the waters activities with soft money. And the answer that in draft C is yes, but if the prospective candidates decide to become candidates, use of such money would violate regulations. This is because when an individual becomes a candidate, payments for testing the waters activities may be made only with funds permissible under the Act. And the problem that I have with that answer is that when an individual becomes a candidate, they're no longer testing the waters. There are no more testing the waters activities to pay for. So if that is the only time when the testing the waters activity regulation applies after somebody becomes a candidate, then it never applies. You're writing the regulation out of the book.
I don't think that's – if there's some ambiguity on that front, that's not what was intended. I viewed this question as being a pretty straightforward question, and it comes down to I think could have even been asked in a different way. I'm not criticizing. I'm not criticizing at all, because I think you had a very specific question in mind. But I think that there's even a larger issue of, can you finance Testing the Waters activities with soft money if you later become a candidate? Is that a problem? And I think that is. I mean, under our regulations, it is very clear that if you find that Testing the Waters activities need to be for people who come candidates, those need to be financed with amounts that are subject to the source restrictions and amount limitations. And now we've had some disagreement about what happens with an individual who was testing the waters and doesn't become a candidate. And we may have some disagreement on that front. But on the question of, can someone use soft money, whether through a 527, a 501c4, a super PAC, what have you, if you're financing those testing and waters activities with money that's outside the amount limitations and source restrictions, then I do think that violates the law. So I hope that clarifies.
That does, and I appreciate it.
Okay.
So if that's the case, is there not another question that we can at least have partial agreement on, even if not on the question of what happens if they don't become a candidate? But it sounds like there's agreement. Sorry to play
Madam Chair.
A deal. But.
Yeah, Commissioner Goodman.
Let me just add to what the Vice Chair said. 11 CFR section 100.72, subsection A, states that funds received solely for the purpose of determining whether an individual should become a candidate are not contributions. Now, then you go down halfway through that paragraph and it states, if the individual subsequently becomes a candidate, the funds received are contributions. It's the becoming candidate that triggers them into becoming contributions.
Right, the funds that were already received, though. When they were testing the waters.
Tries to capture that notion.
It does try to capture that notion.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elias proposed whether or not we might be able to answer another question. Can we take just a quick 2 minutes? I just want to consult if you don't mind.
No, I actually, I think I proposed you had three questions.
Well,
you're talking about 11.12.
Just right here at the table, you added an additional one.
Right.
And to the extent we have a discussion about 11 and 12 during this little break, that's
perfect.
Fine
right.
as well.
And so you're asking for a response to a question that you did not ask.
Well, I think we asked it. I think the Vice Chair was being nicer to me than that and saying that we asked it, but we may have been imprecise. No,
I'm not saying I don't criticize the question at all. I was just saying that he asked about a specific scenario, and I was just saying that I think you could answer the scenario even if it were if you were to substitute a 501c4 for 527.
Right.
So I don't criticize the question at all on this. I was just answering, I guess, the question at a higher level of generality.
Yeah, so, that's good. Okay, let's take a couple of minutes for conversation. Vice Chair has an amendment to draft F to add.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first of all read it just so that you have a chance to hear it before we actually vote on it. It's kind of in chicken scratch here, so if you needed me to show it to you. But the answer to the question, which would be question four.
Is there a draft I can work off of? And
oh, yes. Well,
or am I
let's just go to.
If you would Twitter that to him, maybe it would work.
Yeah.
It's just.
That's
it's true. If you all were on Twitter, you'd get the same annoying tweets at you that they get.
So on draft F, what is it? On page 6, lines 1 and 2. So that's the question that we'll be answering. And so the proposed answer, once you grab that, just like, you good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The proposed answer would be, if an individual becomes a candidate, payments that were made for any Testing the Waters activities must have been made with, quote, funds permissible under the Act, end quote, and a citation to 11 CFR sections 100.72A, 100.131A. The next sentence would be, thus, the proposed organizations possessive, use of funds raised outside of the Act's limitations and prohibitions to pay for individuals testing the water's activities would violate commission regulations if those individuals decide to become candidates. And then a new paragraph would be, the commission could not agree whether a violation of the Act would occur if the individuals never decide to become candidates.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Okay.
Madam Secretary, should I read that again, or did you, or if I share a copy of that, would that be sufficient?
That should be sufficient, and I've got it on tape. I will go back and check it. But this is the answer, proposed answer to question four.
To question four, which I imagine we'll insert on page seven after legal analysis and conclusions, and before question five.
Okay, thank you.
And so I would make a motion that draft F, which is agenda document 15-57-F, be amended with the language that I just went through.
Okay. Commissioner White, go ahead. You go first.
I appreciate that. I'm really glad that I asked the question for clarification, because it's as I said at the beginning, I think that there are glimmers in here that there's more agreement than might at first meet the eye. You know, this issue of whether somebody who never becomes a candidate must have conducted their testing the waters activities with hard money is one on which we have disagreed on in the past. You know, that's open. It actually concerns somebody who did not become a candidate in 2012 but did become a candidate this year, Mr. Trump. So there are, you know, statements and public reports on that. And I acknowledge, while I believe that the testing the waters regulations apply regardless of whether somebody ultimately becomes a candidate or not, I recognize we're never going to reach agreement on that, and I appreciate the effort to find the part of this that we actually do agree on, and I'm pleased to support the amendment.
Did you have a
comment?
Yeah,
I was just going to say, in practical terms, it answers the question. We were not so much focused on people who don't. You know,
right.
Our PACs are going to be involved with people who. We're worried what happens if they become a candidate.
Not what happens if they don't.
They don't.
It's.
Are you working with people that you know have decided to become candidates?
No.
Yeah, I get that, but what I don't get is.
That's a different question, though.
Going to be this. It's going to be yes. And then the last part of it. Is there a Commissioner Hunter?
Can we take a 5-minute break?
Yes, we want to take a few minute.
Okay.
The motion that's on the table is for clarification to amend draft F, and then after this we can go through and either discuss or vote on other drafts if that's amenable with everybody. Okay. Mr. Vice Chair made a motion. Are all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, Madam Secretary, that motion passes unanimously. Are there any other motions or any discussion about any other matters? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect, going back now to question 11, this is more directed at my colleagues. I'm not sure how many of them support the answer in draft E on question 11. I know Commissioner Weintraub does, so maybe I'm directing this question to her, and it's similar to the one we talked about in the hallway yesterday, which is the answer is unclear to me with respect to how far does the prohibition, I guess we could call it, go with respect to an agent who's raising money for a candidate. When can they not change hats now, which, as has been pointed out, is permissible under our current regulations and advisory opinions under this new theory of the law? Is it only if there's a single candidate committee that was established by the same candidate, Or is it, as suggested on page 27 of draft E, line 11, if the candidate's agent would be soliciting funds for an organization that makes independent expenditures in support of the candidate? So if that's the case, that, as I said to you yesterday, is very broad, and somebody who's raising money for a federal candidate may not now be able to go raise money for the Sierra Club because the Sierra Club may run an independent expenditure on behalf of that same federal candidate. And so would you have to, you know, go to these other organizations and say, gee, I can't raise money for you because I raised money for candidate so-and-so, and you may or may not run an independent expenditure. It's just unclear to me how far this goes, which is an additional problem.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I have thought about the question that you asked me in the hallway yesterday, and I went back and looked at it. And I think that my answer is that I propose that we answer the question that was asked, which was about a single candidate super PAC supporting the same candidate or majority PAC, which will, I'm quite sure, have targeted races where they identify candidates that they are going to support. So it won't actually be too difficult to figure out whether they are supporting that candidate or not.
And would the would your answer be the same for both of those? Because the majority PAC raises money for a variety of different candidates and also would participate, I guess, under this hypothetical, I mean question, would participate in raising money for these for these other super PACs. Does that make sense?
No, I think I lost you on the last
Okay. Is your answer the same for both the super PAC and majority PAC?
Yes.
Why?
Because, as I said, majority PAC would be supporting the same candidate that the under this fact pattern that the fundraiser is an authorized fundraiser for.
But majority PAC is not a single candidate super PAC.
I understand that, but your
okay.
question was, would I extend it to majority PAC? And the answer is yes.
Okay, so a fundraiser who's raising money for Hillary Clinton may not raise money for majority PAC.
Actually, I'm not sure.
Oh, wait, no, sorry,
that
wrong person. For a senator, for candidate, a candidate for Senate cannot raise money for majority PAC.
If majority PAC is going to be spending money for that person, yes.
So they should call first and ask majority PAC.
I suspect it will be public information.
It
I don't think it'll be
public.
Hard to figure
it
out.
No, it's not, yeah.
Huh?
Let's
who,
use
who you're going to be supporting?
Whether majority PAC is working with a single candidate super PAC and what the transfer of funds will be between them will not be typically public.
No, I meant just whether majority PAC would be spending on behalf of identified candidates.
So how about making the hypo maybe a little bit more?
But I tell you what, since
okay.
we're plainly not going to agree on that, could we agree on the single candidate super PAC part?
No.
No.
And
okay.
No.
Well, then this is kind of pointless.
No, but with respect to majority PAC, assume that we'll talk about somebody who's already declared, which may or not be part of the question, may or may not be part of the question, but Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire.
Maggie Hassan
in New Hampshire. So she is a candidate, and Majority PAC may or may not run an ad for her in her campaign. I don't know if they already have. But if someone's raising money for her and they then want to go raise money for Majority PAC, they should call Majority PAC and say, are you going to be running any IEs for her? And if so, then I can't raise money for Majority PAC?
Well, as I said, I don't think it's really going to be that hard to figure out. I think there are going to be targeted races, and everybody's going to know who Majority PAC is supporting in those races. So I don't.
So if they're targeted, we just check on the website, maybe look at Cook Political Report, and see if it's a targeted race. And if it's a targeted race, then they can't raise money for Majority PAC?
I don't really understand what the point of your question is. You're not going to agree with me. I have expressed my point of view. You're not going to agree with me no matter what I say. So, you know, when I asked, it actually resulted in further agreement. So that was good. But
maybe,
you know,
I'm not trying to get your vote.
Hmm?
Maybe I'm not trying to get your
right,
vote.
Right. So what's the point?
Because I'm trying to get somebody else's vote. So what about
this? Why don't you talk to that person then?
I have a question, Commissioner Weintraub. I suspect that Mr. Simon would view it as a violation of the coordination rules if we had the conversation that you anticipate we'd have to have, right? If donors who were
I never said anything about a conversation.
Well, but if the donor needs to, if the fundraiser needs to inquire in some form or fashion or find out, they're not going to just say, well, I read it in the newspaper or I assume it's true, because they're going to face liability, right? They're going to feel like they need to get an answer. Is, can I be, if I can't be an agent for both, are they doing that stuff? And I suspect that Mr. Simon would say, and I don't need to speak for him, and I suspect some of you on this side of the table would say that if you had donors who were calling up super PACs and saying, I'm an agent for a candidate, and we want to know, I need to know, are you going to be running ads in this race, that you would frown on that under the coordination rules. So I just want to make sure you are harmonizing your agency
rules. I have never suggested, and it doesn't say in draft E, that anybody would have to call up Majority PAC and ask them who they're supporting.
So if they didn't know, could they proceed? So if they didn't happen to read the website that you think they're going to read, then could they do it?
I think if there's a trying to think back to my previous days as a lawyer in other areas of the law, I think there's a concept out there about what one could, you know, reasonably find out.
Okay.
You know, if it's on your website, here are Majority PACs, you know, targeted races that we're going to be supporting, then I might be skeptical if the person came in and said they didn't know. But if it is actually not on your website and it's not easy to find out, yeah, I think somebody
I have to say, Commissioner Weintraub, and then because I understand your position, you're not going to vote for this, but as someone who counsels clients, and I look at Mr. Patelis, who I first met at the criminal division, it is cold comfort what you're offering. I mean, frankly, it is not law. It is not statute. It's not regs. It's, I hope maybe they check the website, and if they don't check the website, they're probably okay. I'm dealing with folks down the street who have badges and guns, who have announced campaign finance coordination as a priority. So I, with all due respect, I need something a little bit more concrete from the agency, which is why I'm here. If the answer is there's no dual agency and you're repealing two hats, then just say that's what you're doing. If you get four votes for it, then that's the world we're living. If you don't get four votes for it, frankly, we're going to live in the world that the agency has already announced. But frankly, the maybe they find it on a website, maybe they don't find it on a website. Unless you tell me the criminal division is going to take your position, it is absolutely nothing that you're offering us. Of everything that here, that it is nothing we are being offered.
My view's not going to get four votes, so you don't have to worry about it, Mr. Elias. And I'm certainly not sending anybody with guns after you.
Are there other questions, comments? Commissioner Walter.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. You know, I generally have been supporting draft A, and I give a lot of credence to the advice that we get from our general counsel on these issues. So I kind of start from there. But my concern is with the these single candidate super PACs, how that can realistically be expected to be independent if a person who's an agent for the candidate is also raising money for that super PAC. We already have an AO that seems to be in place with respect to what they can do, raise money for another entity. That was some time ago, so it's not like they can't wear two hats. It's just that there's a closer relationship here. And, I mean, could you address that? Could there be some ameliorating language which would say consistent with see, an agent is not really necessarily got the same fiduciary duty as a fiduciary. An agent is an agent. And so sometimes the issues of disclosure are not there. So I'm just wondering, can you suggest any language in connection with a super PAC that might
So I wonder if one way to
reduce that concern.
Yeah, so I wonder if one way to tackle this is to note in the answer to the question that none of this alleviates the anti-coordination obligations, that they can do this, so, but that they need to be mindful that they need to still abide by 109.21, 21, which is one way, Commissioner, that you address the question of how do we make sure this doesn't become a issue of coordination, is we can simply reference the coordination rules and in the AO and say nothing in this opinion, you know, undermines that, you know, or alleviates the responsibility under the coordination rules. I don't know if that I'm looking for a solution, so I'm open
right,
to
I understand, and so am I, and I was thinking of something along that line. I wasn't thinking of tagging it with a reg necessarily, but that's a possibility, or some language.
Yeah.
But, you know, in theory, we're already there in a lot of respects.
We are, Commissioner, and it's so, why the General Counsel's Office so neatly and well put their analysis here.
Yeah,
because they really just sailed behind the existing law.
I understand that.
And, you know, the other thing I would say, Commissioner, is that the line between single-candidate super PACs and non-single candidate super PACs is also a little blurry. Now, I realize we're partially responsible for that. But, you know, if Senate Majority PAC plays in five Senate races, you know, is that it's not single candidate, but it's five. You know, what if towards the end they are only playing in two Senate races, because those are the two Senate races that most need the money? So I think that this is really a place where the commission would do well to follow existing precedent. If you want to heighten the awareness of the coordination rules, that they are uniquely implicated by these kinds of, or not uniquely, they are, there is a heightened concern about that, then I think that would be completely appropriate from my standpoint. But I would really caution against, it would be a bad thing for the agency and for the regulated community if there is doubt cast on whether the FEC is still following its agency rules, which did not change before Citizens United, didn't change after Citizens United. Citizens United didn't say anything about.
So what if the person who raises money is raising money for the candidate and just instinctively knows that there's some taboos that the candidate does not want to address, or has a particular point of view, or has a particular vulnerability, or something really relevant to the takes a position as a fundraiser for the single candidate PAC, and could injure the single candidate PAC if they did not know this.
So, look, that's a concern now, whether it's a single candidate PAC or not a single candidate PAC.
I gather that, but on the other hand,
coordination that would pose a direct issue under the coordination rules and probably violate the coordination rules.
Well, I think that too, but. But that's not so much even coordination. It's just a matter of coordination implies to me that you are there's two that are agreeing on a course of conduct. Where here, this would be somebody would have a fiduciary obligation to the candidate to keep some things confidential. You know, we can't raise that issue, or here's my weakness, or something along that line. And then they go over to the single candidate super PAC, and that issue arises in some way and puts the person, the fundraiser, in a difficult spot as to whether discloses or her knowledge about that particular fact. Would they disqualify themselves? Would they?
I think they would have to.
Would they plunder ahead?
So I think legally they'd have to disqualify themselves under the coordination rules. Otherwise, you'd have a sharing of non-public material information regarding the project's plans, activities, or needs of the.
Well, I like the way you phrase that, so it may go down into history.
That's 109.21. Mm-hmm. I think more realistically, what this is getting at, Commissioner, is, you know, Joe Jones is a big supporter of Congressman Goodlatte, and he hosts a fundraiser at his house. He doesn't know anything about Congressman Goodlatte's campaign. He's just raising money for him. Okay. He's a bundler for him. He's raising money for him. So because he's a bundler or holding a fundraising event, he is an agent. Right. And at the same time he's doing that, he gets called by someone from a super PAC and says, "Hey, can you raise money for us?" And he calls two or three of his friends and says, "Hey, you ought to give to the super PAC." Because at this point, the person who's done it is not doesn't know anything about the project's plans, activities, or needs of the campaign, nor of the super PAC, nor, by the way, does the super PAC care what the person thinks the super PAC ought to do. It's just a question of whether or not they can do that. And to Commissioner Hunter's point, in the case of Senate Majority PAC, which is what perked my ears, and I apologize for my tone, but what perked my ears is this becomes actually totally unworkable for multi-candidate super PACs, right? Because Senate Majority PAC is going to have an agent who's raising money for Senate Majority PAC who may not even care where the money's going. But now they've got to worry whether that person is also holding a fundraising event for a U.S. senator who's in cycle. I mean, and that's just, honestly, that's just completely unworkable. And the idea that they're going to sort that out by looking at the website and trying to figure out which races they're supporting, you know, like I said, you know, and I'll say it more calmly, you know, we are told that the Department of Justice is looking at coordination issues. I am told that. You're not going to confirm or deny that. I think having, you know, they went after someone in what, New Jersey or Virginia?
Virginia.
And the idea that we can't have a clear rule that it's still, there's always going to be some facts and circumstances in it, but the idea that we need to tell donors it's incumbent upon them to sort out the other relationships that these super PACs have with one another. I mean, I think I read that, like, there's three super PACs supporting Senator Cruz, and then someone told me this morning there are actually four. Like, how is a donor supposed to know what the connection is between various outside groups? So,
well, I think the first example you give I can live with, because I understand that to be, you know, fairly clearly the law right now. But here, if somebody has three or four people raising who have their own super PACs, I don't know what you do. I mean, at that point. But if you have one donor, I mean, one person raising money, I'm assuming the closer situation where the person who's raising money is close to the candidate, not because it's like I say, I'm not too uptight about the professional fundraiser who's just he's raising money or she is, and it's the people that raise money and have an otherwise sufficiently personal or professional relationship. So you're really into the candidate's strengths, weaknesses, thoughts, taboos, who you can call, who you can't, type thing.
Look, all of this gets to the question of whether they are actually acting as an agent for the candidate, which would be a problem, a legal problem, or whether they are coordinating, which would be a problem. And I think we can emphasize both of those in the draft. I think the general counsel draft does lay that out, but I think it can be pointed out more clearly. But to your point of what you have said is appropriate and legal, which was my hypothetical, and then the commercial fundraiser hypothetical, would be illegal under the draft, the alternative to that's being offered by, I don't know, Commissioner Weintraub, whether you're offering the draft or just supporting the draft, under that draft. So just to be clear, you know, between two possibilities. And I would suggest that a draft that suggests that the professional fundraiser is illegal and the situation I posit of someone holding a fundraiser here, holding a fundraiser there is illegal, I think is a much bigger, it's a much more common and much more likely scenario, but the second is it would be incredibly disruptive and would not be consistent with existing FEC precedent that people currently rely on. So, like I said, I think there's a way to highlight that it has to genuinely be not on behalf of the candidate, which is, you know, the agency law. They have to be acting on behalf of the super PAC. And then the second is that, you know, they can't violate 109.21, I think is the way to tackle what you're getting at. I don't think it's to vote for the alternative that would ban the other situations.
Well, I'm not suggesting one way or the other. I'm just trying to see how you address that problem. When you, when these two are automatically, in theory, going down the same road without any line drawn between the two lines of traffic.
Yeah.
Okay, Commissioner Weintraub.
Just a point of clarification. I think this is just a little bit of imprecision, but you were talking about how's a donor supposed to know and what's a donor supposed to do. We're not talking about donors. We're talking about fundraisers.
I'm sorry, the lay fundraiser.
Right. So I just.
Yeah,
I just wanted that to be clear.
No, that's fair. The lay fundraiser, yeah.
Commissioner Hunter. I think that's a helpful suggestion, and I'd be willing to amend the answer to question 11 to add the coordination prohibitions of 109.21. I think that's if that helps get to four or five votes, I'm happy to do that.
I'm willing to consider that.
Right.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at draft C. But I guess we could look at either draft C or draft A, which I think are the same except for one footnote. But on the answer to question 11, we answer the question by saying individuals who are agents of federal candidates may solicit non-federal funds to requesters as proposed. And I just would pose this to my colleague, Commissioner Walther, that we could put a footnote there and say this answer presumes that such individuals will act in compliance with 11 CFR section 109.21.
Yes.
Just a clarification question. Mr. Vice Chair, were you referring to 109.20 or 109.21 or both?
I was referring to 109.21.
21?
Yes.
Okay. I guess just to clarify then, because the question is about solicitation, mm-hmm. so it's not immediately obvious that 21 would be the provision implicated versus 20, but I don't.
As the person,
it depends what the concern that commissioners are trying to address is.
As the person who came up with the cite, the reason why I cited 109.21 is that what I understood the hypothetical to be is that you got a super PAC that's going to run television ads or do, you know, paid internet ads, and now you got a person who's close to the candidate who knows that they don't want it run on healthcare reform. They don't. Campaign's not interested in anything on healthcare reform, but does want ads run on national security. So now that person who knows that goes to the super PAC and says, "All right, I'm going to raise money for you. And by the way, you know, don't run ads on healthcare. Run ads on national security." So it would implicate 109.21. That was what I understood to be the.
Well, I understood it a little differently.
Okay, well, you're the commissioner, so.
Yeah. Well, the only reason is the donor would, or the fundraiser would not say anything. He just wouldn't do it.
He just wouldn't do what?
Well, the fundraiser would know enough not to do anything in violation of the agency, you know, the candidate that he's raising money, he or she is raising money for. But when it gets to the single candidate PAC, that knowledge would infuse the way that person raises money, and the actual super PAC people who are in charge of it may or may not wouldn't probably know that. In other words,
that it would be a form of assent that they would.
So that's why I'm saying it's not really coordination. It's just a matter of putting the agent. The fundraiser in a position, and what does the fundraiser do then? So that was my raise. So you're really in a trust relationship, and you can't disclose the information because you are already the agent for the candidate.
Right.
So, but agency and a trustee has got different fiduciary obligations usually. So then you that person is put in the position of raising money for. The super PAC, and that really affects, without having to say anything, you go to television station A and you don't call person B, and you do call person C, and so I'm wondering how does that work in terms of trying to satisfy the appearance of, which is the appearance of independence.
So that's why I do think it's a 109.21, because we're talking about television and public communications.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to jump into here.
I'm interested to see if our general counsel wants to offer some information to clarify that. Maybe we can take some time and see what we can do.
Commissioner Hunter.
Steve, Commissioner Walther, did you want some time to think about that footnote?
And,
okay. Do you? But did you have? Okay, back. We're back on for a moment, Commissioner Hunter.
So, Mr. Elias,
we have another question for you, just sort of somewhat unrelated to what we're talking about, but somewhat related, with regard to the single candidate super PAC. So, when somebody tells the FEC they're going to be a super PAC, they don't say, I'm going to be a single candidate super PAC. And so I sort of don't like calling it that for a variety of reasons, and I generally try not to do that. That's the way you asked the question. But, you know, often I think there's a super PAC who's interested in free market principles or global warming or whatever the issue, and then they may sort of morph into a super PAC that decides to spend a lot of its money on independent expenditures for one candidate, or maybe two, maybe three. And so I think, you know, the distinction that I may be hearing from some of my colleagues that, you know, okay, maybe it is a problem to say that raising money for a majority PAC would be difficult to adhere to and looking at the website and all that. But this single candidate stuff is really bad. And so, again, we don't know often whether...
Did I say that?
No, you didn't say that. I've just sort of felt that. We don't know often when a super PAC, you know, is formed who they're going to support. And that super PAC may not know. I mean, it may depend on a variety of different things, including issues or who's doing well in the polls or whatever. So do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I did ask the question the way I did, and I realize I don't like asking questions that use imprecise language, and right. We did, because single candidate doesn't have a legal definition. It's just a colloquialism. I guess super PAC is just a colloquialism, too. But at least that ties more neatly to something. You're correct about that. I'd actually point out also that sometimes PACs change.
Right.
So I think I recently read that, I may be wrong, but it was either a Fiorina PAC supported someone else in the race, or someone else in the race supported Fiorina. There was some like migration among super PACs, and of course, you
Scott
know,
Walker's PAC.
Scott Walker's PAC, thank you. And in fact, I think there were, and in fact, if you look on the Democratic side, Priorities USA supported President Obama. It then supported in the midterm elections, it gave money to House Majority PAC and Senate Majority PAC to support their efforts. What I read about in the newspaper is that it's going to support someone in the presidential campaign this time. So, it's not always a rifle shot. That creates a practical problem from a regulatory standpoint, because if you created a rule that was just for single candidate super PACs, I imagine every super PAC in America would then go spend $5,000 on a second candidate, or a third candidate, or a fifth, or whatever, or they'd look at their lineage. I don't have a solution to that. But I think it's a practical problem. I think that going back to draft A or draft C, you know, I think the fact is that agency is like one of these things that is just working. Like, you are not facing a deluge of problems or scandals involving agency before this, before the commission. And I'm just not sure why this is the place that the commission, in an advisory opinion where there are going to remain some significant differences on some big issues and compromises on some other issues, why this isn't one of those places, as well as the next question, 12, we haven't gotten to yet, why there couldn't be compromise. Because really all we're asking for in this, which is what C does, is to simply reaffirm. I mean, if you want, you could just answer it by saying, you know, yes, C, you know, Rory Reed and whatever the guy was in Montana.
Iverson.
What was it?
Iverson.
Iverson. Now, okay, got it, right? It shouldn't be that much more complicated than that, I don't think.
Thank you.
Okay, I think that maybe we need to take some time to consider this and potentially also to have lunch for those of you who eat. So I hate to, I know everybody's sitting there and we've got a lot to do today, but yes, Mr.
Can I just suggest that while you're having lunch, that in addition to 11 and 12, and I hesitate to do this because you're going to kill me, but and I'm going to, if I'm not already worn out, my welcome.
You might as well, right.
But to Commissioner Weintraub's first point, it's also not clear to me why questions 5 and 7, I'm sorry, 7 and 10 rather, it feels to me like there is a, you are roughly saying the same thing, just one of you starts with yes and one of you starts with no, but it may be that your view is that it is factors in a finding of candidacy, and yours is that it is conclusive factors, and maybe the solution is to just say they're factors, you know. And some commissioners, some commissioners say they thought it was more than that, but if the Republican commissioners are saying, as I read it, it is relevant factors. Like, there ought to be at least 4 votes for relevant factors, even if your view is it's actually more than relevant factors, it's conclusive. So I almost wonder whether there is another compromise just on that you all can look at, and I'll...
Commissioner Hunter.
Happy to look at that, but I'm just curious, how does that help you?
It's an answer. It doesn't give me the certainty that I wish, but I'm trying to do the best I can here today to get as much information to the regulated and to my clients about if it's a relevant factor, then they know they need to be mindful of it when they engage in these activities with candidates. It may not be conclusive, but they know it's relevant. If you deadlock, we're left with, you know. So I'm actually suggesting that your all's formulation with some reservation of rights by the Democrats, which is sort of what you just did on the last one, might be a solution. It may not be. And I only mentioned it because we were going, if we had ended before lunch, I wouldn't bring it up. But since your staffs don't have enough else to do, I just thought they might look at that as well.
All right. What do you think about timing? It's about 12:25. Do you want to come back at 2?
Sure.
All right. We'll be back at 2. Thank you.
I'll be here.
Thank you all. Secretary, all right. We are reconvening. It's not quite 2. It's more like not quite 3. But... perhaps everyone can kind of give a little report on Mr. Vice Chair, maybe, about where you think we are in terms of, well, I, otherwise I'm not sure how we can continue, go with the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be prepared to support questions 11 and 12 as set forth in draft C right up front, but I'm not sure that I've got the support for that. And just to recap where I think we may be, Commissioner Walther, and I'll let you speak to this, but had requested the Office of General Counsel to propose some potential footnote language with respect to question 11. That would speak to the issue of coordination, and that the conclusion would not affect the application of the coordination regulations. There was some other language that I would be going back to the issue that I think was raised by some of my colleagues beforehand about. I don't draw a distinction between multi-candidate super PACs and single-candidate super PACs, but I know that I think that gives some of my colleagues trouble, and I know that that's an issue that may need to be teased out. So, and I would just say on question 12, I'll just throw something out there that I may have no support from either my colleagues on my left or my right, but I'll at least propose it, that stating the obvious, advisory opinions aren't rulemakings, and we take requests as they're presented to us, and Mr. Elias has presented to us that the proposal here would to be that these events would actually be events, invitations, date certain, indication of a member as a special guest, an actual program, remarks given, whether there might be some appetite to having kind of a stripped down answer saying in answer to the question of whether or not there's a minimum number of guests, we would say no under the circumstances set forth in this request. We don't believe that there is a minimum number. I don't know if that would allow people to kind of keep their powder dry for future, because I know that what we all, I think, have concerns about whenever we make decisions is whether or not we're somehow either going to inadvertently bless things that we don't want to bless, or that we're going to inadvertently paint ourselves into corners that are going to be difficult for us to extricate ourselves out of in future matters. And that's just one proposal on how maybe we could answer the question while still keeping our powder dry for future scenarios that might be presented and future opinions.
Well, I don't think I'd be comfortable with that, but I do think that in 12 there is a potential of saying something which would be a little more clear in response to the question, other than what you have in C, because my concern here is that, first off, I don't think that a gathering of two people would be a fundraising event, even if they did all of those things that are set forth in 11 CFR 300.64. So my way of dealing with this issue would be to answer the question, you know, that it's at the end of the page 19, line 22, that it's unlikely that a gathering of two people would be a fundraising event, and then eliminate the thus in light of requester's representation sentence. Eliminate that.
If I can just add, because I do want to make sure we get our questions answered. Our question was not is two. Our question was, is there a minimum number?
Right.
So that's the question we've asked, and it's the question that I think we should have answered.
I think that clearly it says, in C it says, although requesters propose to fundraise with as few as two attendees, but neither the Act nor the Commission regulations prescribe a minimum number. I mean, that's in the C. So I do not propose changing that at all. But What I want to keep open is the possibility that based on certain...
Keep going. I'm sorry. I now understand.
...circumstances that you may comply with those other provisions that are set forth in your version C, and it still might not be an event. That's my concern or my proposal. So I don't know how else we can go forward here on these two. Commissioner Walter?
I'm not quite so hung up on that because my concern has been that there could be a variety of factors to determine whether or not it's a fundraising event. And so, I think we've, at least I've felt, that could be a challenge in the past, one way or the other. Frankly, we haven't really run across it to any great degree as an issue. But in the regs itself, we refer to a fundraising event, and my view, and is always interpreted, is it has to be a fundraising event. We may disagree and not disagree on what it is. What my concern was is you say, okay, we do this, it's automatically a fundraising event. And we've never said it that way. So I wanted to leave open the understanding that what we're really talking about is compliance with the reg. And you could give all the, engage in all of those various steps. I'm trying to find them right now. But it doesn't necessarily mean one way or the other. These are requirements, but I didn't want to get into the issue as to the fact that it just seals that automatically as a fundraising event. So I also agree that there's no, I mean, I'm not required to, I don't believe there needs to be any thing more than, we do not have a requirement that there needs to be a minimum number, but if in a given case, if you're looking, was it really an event at all, and it's a factor that could be taken into consideration, that's all. Not to be exclusive factor, say it has to be over three, because four could be no better than three. It just depends on, I think the facts involved and who is there and how they got there and what took place. And we've never had that as a big issue, but that's one reason why I'd like to maybe propose some way to take that issue into consideration without trying to make a federal case out of it.
I am before a federal agency. It's already a federal case.
Yes, that's right.
I said it that exactly with that in mind. In case you took me seriously when I said that.
Yeah, that's...
And if you have any thoughts on addressing that...
Well, we tried to lay out in the request the facts that we thought would make it an event. We thought that, which is why I thought, I thought that if by saying that, we would have a program, we would have invitations, I thought gave a level of specificity that it would be a real event. I think that if you look at the draft that the General Counsel's Office provided on this question on draft A, I think the General Counsel's Office does a pretty good job of hewing to the regulations. They do say that neither the Act nor the Commission regulations prescribe a minimum number of attendees for non-federal fundraisers involving federal candidates. Thus, in light of our representations that we will comply with the regulation, which is the regulation that you cite, that they can do it. I wonder if it might help the hang-up of some of... let me put it this way. does it help any one of the Democratic commissioners if we remove the phrase, although requesters propose to fundraise with as few as two attendees? Okay, so that the question that is being asked is, mm-hmm. does it require that there's a minimum, be a minimum number of expected attendees? And the answer is no. And then when we get to that section, it just says neither the Act nor the Commission's regulations prescribe a minimum number of attendees without reference
what,
to...
What page are you on?
I'm sorry. This is draft A.
Yeah.
Page 31, the very last page.
Line 3.
Line 3.
All right. Thank you.
Right, so if you delete the reference to two, which, like I said, was maybe more provocative to put in the request than it was intended, it was simply that if you said there was a minimum number, I wanted to know what the minimum number was. And maybe I should have just said that in the request. But the actual question posed, though, doesn't really hinge on whether it's two or five or 20. It just asks, is there in concept a minimum number? And Commissioner Walther, if you are saying in concept there is no minimum number, then I think if you delete that first clause, then you have the general counsel's draft without reference to two, and therefore it just hinges on is it a real event and have we followed the regulation.
Right, that's a good comment. Now, the next sentence down looks good to me. It says, thus, in light of requesters' representations, they will comply with all of the requirements of CFNR 300.64. That gets me there as long as we don't get the impression that all that they do is just that. You say you comply with that reg, activities that mentioned don't trump your obligations under the reg necessarily.
Correct.
Because, I mean, it even says here, publicity for a fundraising event concludes but is not limited to. Okay, I mean, at least there's elasticity there that I think is important to retain. So something along that line gets me there.
And the risk of asking commissioners questions, other Republican commissioners?
I guess there's three more votes that are required to get this thing through.
Steve, could you say that again?
How far do you want me to backtrack?
I'm sorry?
How far do you want me to backtrack? Basically,
I'm just
saying...
The part where you said the...
If there's a way to make the point clear, like we... I believe is the case, that compliance, the steps that are mentioned are ones which, I didn't read it verbatim, but are included in the regs. But it's important for me to understand that compliance with the regulation itself, that is consistent with the compliance, but the regulation itself is not minimized, the effect of it, by the listing of those various activities that they mentioned will take place beforehand, so that the reg doesn't get watered down by listing those activities. So if you just say that, the compliance, something to the effect that, you get the point.
Yeah, I just wonder if the following language, just to try to pinpoint this, so if we delete, although requesters propose to fundraise with as few as two attendees, and the sentence begins, neither the Act nor the Commission, and then the next sentence says, thus, in light of representations of fact, as well as that they will comply with the... In other words,
That's fine.
So you're buying in the facts that we laid out.
That's fine.
That works? Because we are, after all, only seeking advisory opinion on the facts presented, so...
Which fact?
The facts being that there's an invitation, there's...
But aren't all of those facts listed in the...
Yes, mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
They're listed in the regulation.
No. The facts are that we will have an invitation.
Okay.
We'll have a date certain. We'll have a time certain.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe facts is the wrong word. The representation, is there a better word, general counsel? Facts.
Yeah, and the regs.
Based on the facts represented?
Based on the facts represented.
So do you want to...
I just want to make sure that we're
Okay. Because
I don't think there'd be a problem, but I just. Yes,
can I ask a
Commissioner
Weintraub. Does in light of the facts represented include the fact that you might do it with as few as two people?
I don't think that's a fact we said. I think that was a question we asked if the answer was that there is a minimum number. Does that make sense?
Do I understand, Madam Chair?
I'm just trying to figure out what are the, when you say, you know, you're going to send an invitation, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do that, and we might do that with as few as two people in the room. Is that part of what you were incorporating
in here? It isn't. We never say in our request we may do it with as few as two people in the room. What we say is that we propose to invite prospective donors to an event where, one, funds are solicited in connection with the event exceeding $5,000. Two, prospective attendees are sent or emailed a written invitation. Three, the invitation lists Senate or House candidates as special guests, including the Cantor disclaimer, or whatever we call it now. Four, the invitation includes the date and time where the event will be held. Five, there is a program for the event which includes formal remarks by the Senate candidate or House candidate and an introduction by the event hosts or some other person. Six, the Senate or House candidate complies with 300.64b2 at the time of the event. Seven, neither Senate nor House candidate nor their agents disseminate publicity for the event or otherwise extend invitations to the event. Those are the bullets that set forth the facts. What we then ask, which is what everyone has now hooked onto, is we say S&P and H&P believes the event that events like this are most effective when the number of attendees is small, so the attendees have a more personal experience. May Senate contender or House contender appear, speak out, or be the featured guest at the event described above, if the number of expected attendees is two. But that is only if numerosity is required. If you just answer the question, that isn't under the question presented. The question presented under...
I think you're quibbling.
No, I'm not actually quibbling. If you look question 12, the question 12 is, does the regulation require there be a minimum number of expected attendees before the candidate can permissibly speak, attend, or be the featured guest?
So I guess my question to you is, are you amending your question, which includes that, you know, long series of information and the fact that, you know, there could be as few as two attendees, or are you just trying to bury it?
I'm not burying anything. I'm asking, does the number of attendees, is there a minimum number of attendees? If you begin with the answer no, then we never need to get to the question of the minimum number of attendees. If you answer the question yes, then you have to address, is it two, is it five, is it 10, is it 50? But if the answer is no, and I think I heard agreement among four of the commissioners that the answer is no, then I think the question of numerosity just falls away.
I think that's right, because by saying no, you've already said that it could be as few as two. And, you know, there may well be four commissioners who are content to say that, but that's the result of that.
And I would ask that if it is not, what is the minimum number? That question has been excluded from all of the drafts that come to the answer yes, is what is the minimum number? And it is not a hypothetical, it is a real question. And we deserve an answer to that. Either number matters or number doesn't matter. If number matters, how many people do you need?
Commissioner Goodman,
are
you good? Okay, Commissioner Walther.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask, the way I see it is, I don't think you can say that numbers never matter. It's just that there's nothing required at this time. In other words, if you give, it could be a factor in saying, hey, wait a minute, they didn't have an event. Some guy drove up in a truck, gave him a beer, and they drove off, you know.
Right, but then it's not an event.
That's
right.
The point, and that's the question that I want to raise is that if somebody says, we had an event, I'm going to say, well, yeah, but there's only two of you guys, and you're both sitting in the pickup truck.
But that's why, Commissioner,
factor. It could be a factor.
And that's why I thought we addressed it by saying we are saying as the facts presented.
Yeah, okay.
which I thought addressed that.
Well, if we all end up at the end of the day understanding it's exactly within those factors represented, you know, sure.
Yeah. So. And the question is, are the...
And I'd like to be able to say, for purposes of clarity, just for me, even, when we say no, it doesn't mean it couldn't. It's exclusively out of the picture in terms of considering, for example, whether it is an event.
So
can you live with that? I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, so on the text, I'll live with whatever we can. I'm just trying to see if there are four votes for the two text changes that I proposed, the one being the deletion of that first clause, and then the second is adding, thus, based on the facts of the request, thus, based on the facts represented, and that they will comply with all the requirements, and the requester's representations. Wait, hold on. Based on the facts represented and the requester's representation that they will comply with all of the requirements of, that's what I thought got us there.
Right, and then to put... can you say, in addition to any other requirements that might be required under the reg?
So with all of the requirements of 11 CFR 300.64 commission regulations and other commission regulations. We always seek to abide by all commission regulations.
Do you mind if, I mean, is there anathema to say it could be a factor? There's no requirement at this time, one way or the other. There's none that says you can't do it. It's just saying if you do it, there may be, people may take a second look and want to see what else went on.
Well, I mean, I guess the question is, under the facts we presented.
Yeah. But your facts don't present a number.
Correct.
And so I'm just
saying. But would it matter what the number is under the facts we presented? If there was an invitation.
I don't know. I mean, I doubt it. But,
right. So that's, you know, that's kind of, I'm trying to hold it to what the facts are we presented. Because honestly, if we had 100 people, I might not have a speaking program. Like, I don't want the worst of all worlds, which is I need to have a written invitation.
Yeah.
And we specifically said we would do something very formal because we were looking to see whether it, as you say, you doubt that it would matter, that it wouldn't matter. Understanding that we may do something more colloquial with a much larger room. And not have some of those other event-like things. So we didn't ask, you know, we didn't ask five different variations of events. What if it's big and doesn't have this? Or we just tried to set out something that was actually quite formally an event that anyone would recognize to be an event, and then just ask about numbers. So, if the commissioners are comfortable with that, with the amendments to the language, then I think that would be our proposal.
Okay.
Can I just,
Mr. Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand the proposed edits. I know the striking the language on the prefatory clause on line 3, so the although requesters propose to fundraise with as few as two attendees. We strike that, capitalize neither, and then the next sentence, just to make sure that I think there were some different iterations. Would it be something that thus, in light of requesters' factual representations and also its representations that they will comply with all of the requirements 11 CFR section 300.64 and any other applicable commission regulations when engaging in the specified activity, a federal candidate may attend, speak, or be a featured guest as proposed. Is that?
I had a slightly different formulation, but that's okay. Perfectly acceptable.
Okay.
But if Commissioner Walther preferred my formulation, I
would defer to that as well.
I'll approach and give you.
I don't remember exactly the difference between the two, but they're both.
I think it's probably.
They're semantic.
I think they are substantively the same, maybe semantically slightly different, but I would be happy with either one.
Well, we say neither the Act nor blah, 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 government. Do you have any problem if I say, but under certain circumstances, it could be a factor?
The problem is under certain circumstances, we've laid out the circumstances.
Yeah.
So that's what's hard for me about
are
that.
Are certain circumstances not present here?
Yeah, on circumstances not present
here.
I'm
fine with
is that.
Mr. Noti.
Just want to make sure commissioners are aware that there's a reference if we're in draft A It's page 29, line 10. It's the short answer. There's a reference to the expected number of attendees. Just want to make sure all commissioners. Page, in draft A, page 29, line 10, there's a reference to the There's a reference to the expected number of attendees. That seems to be the continued inclusion of that seems to be fine in light of the changes on page 31, but I just want to make sure commissioners saw that that's there.
Where is it?
It's 29, line 10. It says federal candidates. All right, so are those proposals for draft C, and then there's a draft F with an amendment that we agreed to this morning. Are we ready for a series of votes? Yes?
Before we go to vote, the amendments just being discussed, were they to draft A or to draft C?
I think I think we were working off
on
draft
this one,
A.
But we were working off of A. But you want to move draft C with...
No. Well, but no. I think that what we would be doing here is amending draft F.
With...
And then... And so that we would be, in essence, preparing draft F to be voted on after we go through a series of...
other votes.
Other votes, just so that
we can
all be on...
I don't know that that's... Right.
Well, actually, I think it could be right if we break up the votes.
Right.
So what I would prefer is to move draft F as amended earlier today, but without any amendments addressing questions 11 and 12 first, because I would support that motion. And then there could be a second motion where you move the answers to 11 and 12. To the extent that there's agreement. And honestly, you know, I know Mr. Elias is going to kill me for this, but he's going to take out the gun. But as I listen to what people are saying at the table, I'm not sure that there actually is agreement here, because what I hear Commissioner Walther saying is that he thinks that the number could matter, but you're agreeing to an answer that says the number doesn't matter. So, yeah. I'm not really sure what's going on.
I think if you read it, Commissioner, it says prescribe a minimum number of attendees. I'm saying that there's not a prescription for a minimum number, period, except for one maybe, right?
It'd be a heck of a fundraising event being there alone.
But
doesn't sound very successful.
Right.
And who the candidate is.
And the mirror on the wall. So it's just eliminating that as a minimum requirement. Not to say it couldn't be a factor when you look at all the factors and decide, you know, this wasn't a real true fundraising event. It was a mock event. But the way this is structured, we're saying on the facts present here, I could live with that. I mean, all of this it has to deal with good faith compliance anyway.
Did you have something that you wanted to mention, Commissioner?
I don't know if there are four votes, but just going back to the procedural question on how to get there.
Right.
I take it that Commissioner Weintraub would like to vote on F as is.
As amended earlier.
As amended
table.
Earlier,
yes.
But okay,
yes.
As
right.
The base.
Yes.
And then what would be the form of the motion? Usually you propose amendments to that, and they either pass or fail, but then that would put you in the position of voting for an F that you later did not support. So I'm just asking procedurally, assume that there were four votes for 11 and 12 as amended to go into F. I understand you want to vote for F as is.
Or without any answer to 11 and 12.
Right.
Do it that way.
But then leaving open the opportunity to then amend F with 11 and 12 or add them to 11? I'm just looking for the form of that motion.
I think we have in the past, I'll let Mr. Noti speak after a second, but it's my understanding that we have sometimes done this, where we sequence the votes and say we're moving the answers to these questions. Mm-hmm. You know, we're moving the answers to questions 1 through 9 as set forth in agenda document F, as amended earlier today by Commissioner Peterson's amendment. And that would pass, but it would not necessarily address 11 and 12, and then there would be a subsequent motion that would say we now move to adopt the answers to 11 and 12.
One way to do this under Robert's rules is seriatim and take up the questions one, and then at the end of the day, you might have had 6 votes on some of them, 5 on some, 4 on some, and everything that got 4 or more goes into the final draft. That's one way to do it. I think, however, without objection, the chair could amend something already adopted to see if it gets 4 votes to amend. I mean, without, but I think it takes a contortion of Robert's rules motions to do that, but I think we can do that without objection. Adav, is that how you...
Maybe. We thought about this possibility and had a few ideas. One would be either by consensus or by vote. The commission could agree right now that the final AO will be draft F, including any amendments that are agreed to by a majority of commissioners, which would obviate the need then at the end to vote on draft F, which is going to include something that at least 3 commissioners will object to. So if the commission agrees now, we will vote on draft F, and then any additional amendments will be incorporated into the final.
Yes.
There wouldn't need to be a final vote.
Yeah, just do the amendments after the fact, basically.
Right. Without a final vote on the resulting document.
And Larry, with Mr. Calvert, without objection, that'll work, right? I mean, if there's an agreement of the body to handle it that way. Okay.
Can I ask a procedural question?
Just a minute. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask, another question is, I also assume that we probably want to have motions on kind of our perfect world drafts, just so that, which I think is helpful just for the sake of the record, so that people can know, okay, this is where people really were before they found the middle on draft F. So I don't know if that would mean that you'd want to move draft E first.
I actually have a slight amendment to draft E, but
okay, and then we would make a motion with respect to draft C, and then I think that we could then move to draft F
and then amendments
move
to F or additions to F.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes,
I just have a procedural question. Not that I get a vote here. Is there something odd about adopting a draft that says 11 and 12 deadlocked, when in fact 11 and 12 won't have been deadlocked?
Yeah, I agree. That might be an issue.
Like, would it make more sense to vote draft F without answering, with anything for 11 and 12,
and that's sort of what I was suggesting, that we could have the answers of 1 through 9 as set forth in agenda document F as amended earlier today by Commissioner Peterson. That's already been incorporated.
Yeah,
I think.
Draft F only answers 5 questions as it stands right now.
Yeah, it's not all of them.
Right. All draft F says at the end is, so they're the answers to the questions, and then it says the commission could not approve by 4 votes the answers to the other questions. So whatever gets added to draft F will necessarily not be included in the line that says we couldn't approve an answer to the other questions. That's all it says. It doesn't specifically say there's no answer to 11 and 12.
Oh, I see. It doesn't delineate them.
Correct. It just says we don't have answers to the other questions.
And we will vote on the other 2 immediately after today, right? Like at this meeting. Because I don't want to leave this meeting with an answer to 11 and 12.
Right.
That is, you couldn't agree.
Why don't we take the vote?
And why don't we see where
see
the chips
how we
fall?
Go. Right.
So otherwise, I prefer seriatim.
Otherwise, you're going to stay overnight, not leave the meeting?
No, he'll come back tomorrow with the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we
Hold on. Before we proceed, can I ask Mr.
Sure.
Walk me through why you would prefer seriatim, because I don't know that there. I don't know if there are 4 votes on 11 and.
Yeah, there are.
There are
at least for 12.
Okay, if there's confidence, then we're okay.
If you all have confidence, we have 4 votes for 11 and 12. I'm
well.
Good.
Then you're okay with this procedure.
And I'm okay with this procedure.
Well, I guess if I'd want to wait to finish our discussion here, but I mean,
I'm not sure there's anything.
Well, I think we're ready to take a vote.
Madam Chair, I think that Commissioner Walter is referring to the fact that we've now talked about 12, and I think we may have a place where we can land on 12. There was the earlier question about 11, right, and the proposed footnote that OGC drafted up at Commissioner Walter's request. And Steve, if you don't mind, if you have a question, I defer to you, because there was a question I wanted to ask Mr. Elias with respect to that, but I'd be happy to defer to any questions you
have. Go for it.
Okay. So this would on so this would be with respect to I'll just work off draft A for right now, since that's the one I have in front of me. The footnote at the end of the of the short answer, I think would be replaced. I know in footnote in draft C we do not have that footnote because that's not applicable to our analysis of other questions. But substituting that footnote, Commissioner Walter requested that a footnote, or at least I'm not saying he's necessarily endorsed this, but some proposed language that was drafted up by the Office of General Counsel was that the Commission could not approve a response by the required four affirmative votes to the question of whether the individuals would be permitted to raise non-federal funds on behalf of the single candidate committees, and then cite 52 U.S.C., 3106C, and 11 CFR 112.4A. And the question I have is, this would be, we've never really, I mean, the number of matters, and matter of, excuse me, the number of advisory opinions where we've opined about the nature of super PACs isn't very numerous, and this would be the first time when it would indicate that there is some division on the commission between multi-candidate super PACs and single-candidate super PACs. I don't think that that would be a commission blessing of that distinction. I think that that would just merely be, especially in light of the fact that we will have a draft C that will be voted on as well, which would indicate that there isn't a division. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on some on what, how you think that that sort of proposed language might work, and whether or not you think that that would be problematic.
Can you?
I'd be happy to reread
it.
It
one more time.
Okay, and if you need me to,
so I'm trying to find what language you're. Where am I?
Oh, okay. So this would be the short answer. Oh, so question 11, short answer.
What page is this? I'm sorry.
So page 27 of draft A.
Yep.
So it has a footnote 13. Instead of that footnote, we strike that footnote, and substitute this language in instead. And it would say, the Commission could not approve a response by the required four affirmative votes to the question of whether the individuals would be permitted to raise non-federal funds on behalf of the single candidate committees. As I understand where my colleague may be going, oh, and then I let me add, there would then be citations to 52 U.S.C. section 3106C and 11 CFR 112.4A. And as I understand my colleague's concern, they would be willing to approve this, give an affirmative answer to this question, at least with respect to the, you know, quote-unquote multi-candidate super PACs. But not to the single candidate super PACs.
We say the single candidate committees, as described in the request. The reason I ask is that I'm thrilled that I created a new term of art, single candidate committee. But I'm afraid if you use it in your answer unqualified, it will mean a lot of different things to different people. So
it'll be like super PAC. You'll be the guy who invented the new. I mean, people are using that term.
Madam Chair,
or did we?
Mr. Noddy, please.
Actually, it's
Madam Chair,
Mr.
I would.
We didn't use it in our request.
I would.
Mr.
Yeah.
Noddy.
For right. So it's not in the request. It's a defined term in the. It's a defined term in the draft. And it's defined to mean these committees that are at issue in the draft. So, if capitalized as it is, in the written version that you have, it would refer only to these committees and not to single candidate super PACs. And I would recommend the commission use the defined term because it's used everywhere else in the draft.
Yeah. So I'm
fine. Would there be a problem then with us putting a parenthetical saying something as earlier defined in the request or something like that?
Yes. Perfect.
As earlier defined in the response.
Or as defined above
or
something.
Yeah, in the advisory opinion, not in the request.
Yeah, right.
Where is it defined?
Mr. Noddy, could you... I have Commissioner Hunter whispering. Could you just point us to the specific place where that's defined just for our own edification?
In draft A, it is page 2, lines 7 and 8.
Okay.
That's defined. It quotes the request and says hereinafter, the single candidate committee, so referring specifically to those proposing the request.
What's that one?
Page 2 what?
I see that there's some discussion amongst...
Yeah, I think as long as it's limited to the definition...
As set forth
as set
in the
forth
draft
in
itself.
The draft.
But if the definition is what Mr. Noddy just said it was, it's not really a definition.
As long as it's limited to the definition.
It is in the sense that it's describing that category.
I don't think I'm going to go for that.
We're only talking about
no, I'm too worried about it. I'm too worried about it.
I mean, the reason why I say that is that we asked about a particular type of super PAC, which is one that is established, financed, maintained, controlled, or so, I should say established, by majority PAC and a potential candidate, a pre-candidate, a non-candidate.
Right. So this is not the definition.
But that is the definition. That's what I'm...
Mr. Noddy.
The language in the draft isn't just intended to say that the capitalized term single candidate committee as used in all six drafts refers only to the committees that the request proposes to establish, not to single candidate super PACs as a general term. It's about these committees and no others. That's what that language is intended to encompass.
Is he talking about
right here? So in other words, single candidate committees is defined as where majority PAC or House majority PAC, Senate majority PAC will work closely with a prospective candidate and their agents to establish these entities.
And from where are you reading when you say that part?
It's page 2, lines 6 and 7 of draft A.
Of draft A?
Right.
But what if you work closely with them to establish a, you know, joint fundraising committee among several candidates? My problem is I don't think this really defines anything. It's kind of a non-definition. But that's just me.
But you're saying that the definition follows, not just in lines 6 and 7, but throughout that paragraph.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So it's not just lines 6 and 7.
I know. I was just pointing you to where it began.
Right. Okay. So that's what I thought as well at first, that it really wasn't a definition, but we mean the whole paragraph, in which case it is a definition, I think.
I mean, can you put in the parenthetical that?
What's that?
Can you put that in the parenthetical that Commissioner Peterson proposed?
Yeah.
Just a suggestion. Maybe we want to move the here and after the single candidate committees to the end of the paragraph.
That's what I was thinking.
But you want to encompass the entire paragraph.
Ellen was saying move the here and after to the end of the paragraph. So it's all of this is the single candidate committee. So it's really go back to not just this part of it, but the whole paragraph. Yeah, I guess so. Go ahead.
And I'll just Commissioner Walther, I may be stepping all over your toes on this, and you shut me off at any point. There was another footnote that he proposed that deals with the coordination issue that I believe would be added to the end of the to the last sentence in answer to question 12. So this would be on page 29, line 5. And this would say, the commission notes that this conclusion does not affect the application of the coordination regulations, and then cite.
This is question 11.
Right. Last sentence of question 11. So the commission notes that this conclusion does not affect the application of the coordination regulations, and then a citation to 11 CFR sections 109.20 and 109.21.
Seems right.
Just to address the
issue. Yeah, that seems right.
I think that's
what we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
I was suggesting it was 109.21, but it's on hypothetical, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, any further comments? Do you want to start with draft C, or do you want a motion on?
No problem with either one.
You're going to vote on the ones that are.
We're going to go for the ones that
we're
don't
go for
have
our perfect world
four
versions
votes.
Right now.
Perfect world, yes.
And then let's finalize.
And then we'll go, and then we're going to finalize where we can find agreement.
Okay. Right. Okay. Go ahead.
I'll be happy
to begin
by moving. In consideration of advisory opinion request 2015-09, Senate Majority PAC and House Majority PAC, I move the adoption of agenda document number 15-57-C, which is otherwise known as draft C.
Questions, comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed?
Nay.
No. All right. Madam Secretary, that motion fails 3-3 with Commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and Vice Chair Peterson voting aye, and myself, Commissioner Walther, and Commissioner Weintraub voting no. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a slight amendment to draft E, so I move approval of agenda document 15-57E, which is labeled draft E, with the following amendment that on page 13, line 12, we substitute a semicolon for the period at the end of the sentence and add the following citation. Advisory opinion 2007-1, open paren McCaskill, close paren, open paren, concluding that a federal candidate and office holder's campaign committee for state office, comma, formed years before she became a federal candidate and office holder, comma, was, quote, directly established, finance maintained, and controlled by her, comma, end quote, i.e., by a federal candidate, and thus was subject to the restrictions of 52 U.S.C. section 30125E1. And I will provide that to the Secretary to make sure we get that.
Clarification, that's draft E, page 13, line
12.
12. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. With that revision, questions, comments? All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No.
No. No.
Okay, that motion fails. Commissioner Weintraub, it's 4-2 against. Commissioner Weintraub and myself voting yes. Commissioners Walther, Vice Chair Peterson, Commissioner Hunter, and Commissioner Goodman voting no. Draft, the first draft F.
Now, just to clarify, did we do without objection to make this the base draft, so to speak, or do I need to should I make an actual motion toward that end?
I don't think it's been done yet. So either a motion or an agreement by consensus that if draft F gets more than three votes, the final AO will be draft F as amended by any other majority votes that come right after it.
So moved.
So moved.
Do you see any? Should we have a motion that moves all those that we understand are for the agreement, as opposed to the paragraphs that says we can't reach agreement and then try and reach agreement?
Exactly.
Well, the way the draft is written now, they can't reach. There are still going to be some things on which we can't reach agreement, and it's not specific as to what those are. It will refer to whatever's left over at the end of all the votes.
So are you comfortable with the fact that we vote for draft F, basically, and then we come back and amend draft F?
Draft F, as it was amended,
as we amended this morning.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
the goal.
And then
that's the first vote.
Be kind of consistent.
And then there's going to be a second vote to include those other matters.
Right.
Okay.
And just to be clear, this draft, it answers questions 4, 5, 6, 8, and 9 after the amendment today, just so anybody who's following along at home knows what's covered in this draft, and then we'll deal with the subsequent questions.
I feel sorry for those people.
Yeah, they're asleep.
Yeah.
Then we've got to answer them in the same order.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? All those in favor of draft F as amended this morning, as described by the vice chair, please indicate by saying aye.
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 All right. Madam Secretary, that motion passes unanimously. Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. And Commissioner Walther, if you make sure that I'm making this motion. And let me also ask, Mr. Noddy, should I just make my motions that I move to amend draft F as follows? If I preface my motions as such, will that be sufficient?
Should be perfect.
Okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure.
For me, we would be incorporating the answer to draft A.
He's going to
see what I mean using that language.
Yeah, yeah. I have draft A as my base.
All right.
I move that we amend draft F, which just to go back and make sure I have the correct agenda document, which is agenda document 15-57F. That we amend it to answer question 11 as set forth in draft A, subject to the following amendments or the following edits. That the footnote on line, I mean, excuse me, that the short answer to that question on page 27, lines 14 and 15, that the footnote at the end of that be substituted with the following language. The Commission could not approve a response by the required 4 affirmative votes to the question of whether the individuals would be permitted to raise non-federal funds on behalf of the single candidate committees, then parenthetically add, as defined above, close paren, period, citation to 52 U.S.C. section 3106C and 11 CFR 112.4A. That this answer be further edited with the following addition. On page 29, line 5, that at the sentence that ends with on their behalf, that there be a footnote added saying, the Commission notes that this conclusion does not affect the application of the coordination regulations, period. Citation to 11 CFR 109.20, and 109.21, period.
Okay. Is that clear, Madam Secretary?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You missed the...
Or you missed... Is there
you missed the parenthetical,
didn't
you?
There's some kind of thing.
Yeah. That's back on page 2. I believe that this is part of this motion on page 2 that we would make the change so that we...
That would be a parenthetical.
What's that?
That's
the yeah, right. The parenthetical here and after the single candidate committees, which is currently on line 7 and 8 of page 2, that be moved to the behind the last, was it the last paragraph? At the end of the paragraph.
Mr. Vice Chair, we have another proposal you might want to consider that might work a little better.
I'm always happy to hear.
Could we,
Mr. Noddy, thanks.
Could we propose just to reword, and this is in draft F now we're talking about, that...
Well, it's... Yeah.
It's... Well...
A into F.
It's in F also, but... Well, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Regardless.
The beginning is still F, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, the beginning is F.
To simply take out the word here and after and say, instead, as described herein.
Okay.
What page is that?
Page 2.
Page 2. Oh, right. Okay.
So just as described herein, comma, the single candidate committee.
Right. Delete here and after and replace with as described herein.
Okay. And then put that parenthetical at the end of the paragraph.
We were conceiving of it as or avoiding the need to move it and create the weirdness that the term is then used before it's been defined.
That would be, but, I think that would be. Mr. Noddy, could you just, so you're replacing here and after with?
As described herein.
And moving that to the end of the paragraph?
No, at the same spot, right?
The idea would be to leave it there because the term is then used multiple times before the end of the paragraph, so it would just be a little confusing to not define it until the end, but it was
okay.
Just...
Right.
So.
Does that capture that language then defining single candidate committee where you were going to put it in the parenthetical in question 12?
Right.
Well,
question 11.
Right. No, that's an additional. We would have to then say in Steve.
That's going to be, I think that's going to be part of the motion with respect to question 12.
Okay. I'm sorry. Wrong question.
Can't imagine why any of us would be getting mixed up on that. But no, I'll make sure that's included. Not a problem.
Okay, so your changes are on page 2, page 29. Sorry, an earlier one, too.
I have page 2, page 27.
27.
And page 29.
Okay. Is that clear, Madam Secretary?
It is clear, but I want to take a look at the text again from the draft. Just to take one further quick look at it.
Okay.
In other words, we've been negotiating on a few points, but I want to take another look at what all that paragraph says. And,
okay.
Do you right now, or
do you want to go through and get 11 and 12 kind of
Would you like me to make a motion as to both right now, and then you had a chance, or do you want to do?
Let's do that. Just get that part.
So I'll in the same motion then.
Just a minute, Madam Secretary.
Can I ask for clarification? I'm trying to follow along. Okay, I'm clear with what we're doing on page 27, and then we're backtracking to page 2 and changing line 7 to now read as described herein. In the parenthetical.
Was it herein or hereafter?
Hereafter.
Herein.
And then...
I'm sorry. I think it's line 4.
I think it's line 7.
Depends on
I'm working off of draft A.
Draft A.
I was looking at...
Actually, I think we're now looking at draft F. Since the same language is in draft F, and since we're amending it, it probably makes sense to stay in that draft.
Bear with me.
Yeah, I know. There's quite a few to juggle.
So we're going to say in draft F, on line 4 of page 2, as described herein.
As described herein?
Striking here and after.
Okay.
Replacing it with... as described herein.
Okay.
Okay, and now we're at page 29, if I may continue. And at the end of line 5, we're adding a footnote that OGC had provided.
Yes, the one regarding the application of the coordination regulations.
Okay, and that footnote will read, the Commission notes that this conclusion does not affect the application of the coordination regulations, period. Then the citations of 11 CFR 109.20 and 109.21, period?
Correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Elias.
I apologize, but the problem with doing what you've just done is we lose the requester's proposed to work closely with prospective candidates or agents, including establishing. We lose the establishing language because you're now talking herein, and that comes right before herein.
That's what I was trying to say.
Should we? Would it?
We could just define it. We could just say, "Single candidate committee is hereby defined as," and then spell it out.
That's fine. I don't want to lose that because that's the heart of what we're asking about.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Are you dropping herein after and replacing with herein was intended to encompass the whole thing rather than herein after, which is only after. But at this point,
one possibility, which I credit Mr. Burke on, would be to lowercase single candidate committees in both of those two places, and then at the end of that paragraph, say, defined as capital single candidate committees.
Wait, say that again?
It would be to put at the end of that paragraph. There would be lowercase single candidate committees, lowercase single candidate committees, then at the end of the paragraph, defined as single candidate committees in capital. Would that work, or does that not solve it?
I just think it might be cleaner to say, for the purposes of this AO, single candidate committees are defined as a super PAC that raises funds in unlimited amounts, blah, 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 and sort of list it out. No?
We're only talking about super PACs. That would almost seem like a more global definition.
No. Just the super PACs that we're talking about here.
I'm almost ready to go back to herein because I think... is there some other word that we could use that would indicate it is used globally throughout, whether there's a reference to that before or after that parenthetical?
How about saying something like as defined or described in this paragraph?
That's kind of where I was trying to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
As defined in this paragraph or as described in this paragraph?
Yeah.
But does that mean that it's only limited to that paragraph?
How about as described in this paragraph and elsewhere?
Okay, as described in this paragraph and throughout this request and throughout this draft.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure. There you go. All right.
Oh, it's we're on item one of seven items.
We're on a roll.
All right. Is that it?
Is that understood by the secretary?
I think so.
as described in this paragraph and throughout the...
And throughout this request.
And throughout this opinion.
Opinion?
Whatever, yeah.
All right. Any questions, comments about the... Did you make a motion?
And I think that I need to add to that motion that I believe Commissioner Walther wanted me to also include the question 12 in this, or did you want to do separate motions with respect to 11 and 12?
I think we can get the language squared away, and we can vote on them separately. Either way you want. I'm still going to take a minute here.
Okay. I think we're...
So, you might as well just do them together.
Well, then let's rephrase them.
Yeah, just do them together.
Should we just do them? I'll just add it as part of my motion, just on question 12 as well.
Sure.
I think considering that we're... In some ways, there is some overlap, and whereas... I know that the chair is looking at her
it's
watch as she...
It's 4:00 and we have a number of things to go.
So this... let me first ask Madam Secretary... As part of the footnote, the first footnote that was on page 27, did that include the parenthetical after on behalf of the single candidate committees, a parenthetical that says as defined above?
No.
Okay. That's also part of the motion, the as defined above, just to make sure that We are belt and suspenders as to what we own.
I apologize. I do have that written in the margin.
Okay. Just want to make sure. Then I would also propose that in answer to that we also amend draft F to include an answer to question 12, and we will use as the base the answer in draft A, which starts on line 6 of page 29 and extends to line 7 of page 31. The final the paragraph on page 31 from 3 to 7 will be modified as follows. Although the requesters propose to fundraise with as few as 2 attendees, comma, that language will be stricken or struck. What's the appropriate tense? Neither will be capitalized. And the rest of that sentence will just read, neither the Act nor Commission regulations prescribe a minimum number of attendees for non-federal fundraisers involving federal candidates. The next sentence will read, thus, in light of requesters' representations that they will comply with all the requirements of 11 CFR section 300.64 and any other applicable commission regulations, we will insert after 300.64. When engaging in the specified activity, a federal candidate may attend, speak, or be a featured guest as proposed. Oh, I see waving hands. So.
Okay, Mr.
Stefanik. Yes, just one minor thing. Instead of its representations, I believe it should be their representations.
Okay, yeah.
If you wouldn't mind making that.
Thank you. I consider that a friendly amendment. Okay, is that clear? Okay.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Any questions, comments about the motion?
Hang on a second.
Okay.
We still haven't finished the discussion on whether or not we can mention that number is a factor.
I'm sorry. Did you have a question? What was the question?
The number can be a factor.
And
can I just make one more? I think one more kind of a technical amendment that needs to be made is on page 30, line 10. There's a footnote 15, which is would need to be stricken because it's not relevant to that's a relic from the old draft, and that wouldn't be carried forward to to draft F.
Okay. Did you get that, Madam Secretary?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Point of clarification? Were you going to leave in on page 29, line 10, regardless of the number of expected attendees or not?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat?
I was asking as a point of clarification whether the phrase regardless of the number of expected attendees was going to remain on page 29, line 10.
I was going to include that. I didn't hear any objections to that. So.
That is what is important to us, is we have given you the detail of what this event is. We've told you what the format of it is. We've told you the invitation. To say that there are then, I understand, Commissioner Walther, your point that in other circumstances, numerosity could matter. But all we're asking, what we agreed to was that's why we would cabin it to just the facts of this request. So that it is not addressing anything other than an event exactly like this one. In other events, it might involve other facts and other factors. But for this event, as contemplated, numerosity wouldn't matter. So that's why I thought it was intended to be left in, because that's why we brought you all the details about the event.
Just a further point of clarification, when you talk about what we've agreed to, you don't get a vote, Mr. Elias, so it's a question of what they've agreed to.
I understand.
All right. Commissioner Walther.
Let's get some clarification, though. It's still important to me that if I think what's left unsaid is, no matter what people do with the language, there could be facts one way or the other that might sway what actually would satisfy a fundraiser.
I think that that's right, Commissioner.
The crux of your question was, does numbers matter? And my factor, or is there a minimum number, as I recall? And the answer is no. There's no minimum number. But it doesn't mean that you can't consider it when you take a look and see if it was really a fundraising event that is entitled to credit as a fundraising event.
Right. And I agree with you about
that. I need that clarification, that's all.
Yeah, and I agreed with you about the two guys in a pickup truck, which was your.
That's the point.
That was your example.
Or maybe three guys.
And that's when we added the language about it only being applicable to the facts as represented here, because I would propose that under the facts we've set forth, it actually doesn't matter the number, that you have the relevant facts for that particular kind of event, where there's an invitation, where there's a set time, where there are remarks, that in that circumstance, it's not two guys in a pickup truck. Now, if you want to include I don't know what the other commissioners think, something that says that if the facts were different than this, it might be a factor.
True, but that doesn't mean that there couldn't be. I could see somebody taking the skeleton and using it no matter what the facts are, and it still might not be right. And that's my concern, to say, and maybe if we just said no, I guess that's a possibility.
I proposed that hours ago.
At the very outset. Right. No, there's no minimum number, period. And without having to necessarily bless this particular thing with these adjectives is compliance.
I would be
see the point?
I'd be totally fine with just a straight no. I think, honestly, that is a wider answer, not a narrower answer. Because then the answer is just no. And then you're two guys with a pickup truck. I mean, I think I thought that what you were trying to do is by cabining it to these facts, you were narrowing it. But I proposed several hours ago, if we just say no, my clients are fine.
But it can be a factor.
Well, just no.
I couldn't agree to not saying that you couldn't look and see if there's two guys in a pickup truck or there's 20 people standing around a bunch of pickup trucks. Do you see what I mean? It kind of depends on what occurs.
But with all due respect, Commissioner, we're here seeking an advisory opinion so that we have a shield. I mean, you're worrying about what other people may do. A real client trying to hold a real event. Yeah. Okay, and we're trying to get a shield against liability, which we're entitled to under the statute and the Commission's regulations, and we've proposed the specific facts that we're going to engage in. And either that's okay, regardless of the number, and then it's no, with or without cabining it to the facts, with or without, or the answer is yes, which is where I think Commissioner Weintraub is. The numerosity does matter, but I do think we're entitled to a not have a facts and circumstances further than the facts and circumstances we've proposed for this transaction. If other people want to do different facts and circumstances, two guys with a pickup truck, 10 people without an invitation, 50 people with an invitation but no formal program, they're on their own. They don't get but I think we're entitled to an answer under the set of facts we put forward, because no one has proposed it's a hypothetical, and therefore it's a complete request, and therefore we should have the certainty of an advisory opinion as to whether or not that's okay for these facts.
I just want to say, it's not clear to me that there's actually a meeting of the minds on this question, maybe on 11, but it sounds to me, just listening to this discussion, like what Commissioner Walther wants to say is, no, there isn't a minimum number that's set forth in the regulations, but it could be a factor because of the concern that other people are going to take this and say, well, it says, no, there's no minimum number, therefore I can do it with two people or three people or however many people I want, because that's what it says in this request. And if you want that qualification in there, that number can be a factor, I think you better build it in and see if you can get agreement on that, because otherwise number's not going to be a factor.
If it's a factor for other requesters with other facts, that's fine. But you can't say no, it doesn't matter, but we still reserve the right if an FEC complaint gets filed and you do exactly what you told us we'd do. You spend 8 hours before us talking about this, and then you did exactly what we told what you told to do, and then we get an FEC complaint, and then I get discovery, my head's going to explode. Because I will have come to the agency and asked, if I hold this event with these facts, does number matter? And if I then hold an event with these facts, and people show up, and someone files, and the Republicans file a frivolous complaint, I should be able to say, I came to the agency, I asked them, and there were no other facts that matter because I fall within the four square of the advisory opinion I sought. If facts should matter for other people, then say, other facts may be different, other circumstances may be different. But for this request, I have to say, I don't think there are any other facts that could matter other than the ones we proposed. If other facts mattered, the time to tell me that was when I waited 9.5 days for the general counsel's office to put this on the public record and deem it request, or when I sat here last time and answered questions and could have submitted more facts. There are no more facts to have. The question is, do I get an advisory opinion that says I get safe harbor or don't I? And I apologize for raising my voice, but the idea that I am now at the end of this process being told that more facts could matter, well, I wish Dan Patelis had told me that 45 days ago.
Commissioner Hunter.
I think we're actually closer to an answer than Commissioner Weintraub suggests. She's just being so helpful.
I'm not trying to be mischievous here. It's just that I mean this in complete sincerity. It is not clear to me that everybody's on the same page.
Well, I certainly don't want to speak for anybody, but my understanding of what Commissioner Walther was saying was there are sort of two different paths on this answer to question number
12.
I can't remember if it's 11 or 12. 12. And one answer is, no, the number doesn't matter, but, and then he wants to kind of keep his powder dry for another circumstance, and that's what Mr. Elias just addressed. And I can't vote for that, which is what I had told you before, because it, for the reasons that Mr. Elias suggests and other ones as well. The other path I think that you were considering is the one where it cabins it in, you know, to these specific circumstances. And I haven't said this to you, but I have some trepidation to agree to that proposal. I'm willing to do so, but it's not ideal. I think it is truly a compromise, and I'm willing to do it. And the reason why is because it does, in a sense, one could interpret it to mean that the only way that you would get a shield is if you do have an invitation, if there is a program for the event, which includes formal remarks, blah, blah, blah. So it adds stuff that, to me, aren't required by the regulation. To me, as long as you follow the regulation, then you have an event, and I don't care how many people are there. But now you're adding in other stuff here because the requester added it in, and in order to get this safe harbor, you can't be two guys in a pickup truck because then you wouldn't have had an invitation and there wouldn't be formal remarks, blah, blah, blah. So I'm willing to go to vote with you on that, but I think, you know, your first path down the road probably wouldn't get support, and Mr. Elias explained at least in part why. But the second one, I think, does allow you to fight the fight another day with different facts.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add that I think that that I think there is actually a meeting of the minds here. And I think that what's proposed is actually the very definition of compromise. And I commend Commissioner Walther for all the efforts that we've gone back and forth, not only today, but in the past as well. I think we've each side's had to give something on what would, I think, be their ideal answer. But I think what we've wanted to do is answer the question that was presented by the requester here. And not go beyond that. But also, we're doing it in a careful way so that we don't neither of us feels like we have boxed ourselves in ways that we're not comfortable with. And I think that the proposed edits to the language accomplish that for both sides. And so I think this is actually, I actually do think that there are, that we, I think I understand what I'm voting on. I think that there is agreement, but I think that there's also, we also agree that we're not deciding other permutations of factual situations that could arise in further cases. I don't think we're locking ourselves in on any of those at this time. I think that those, in those cases, our powder is dry to make those determinations as they come before the commission. And I think there's just one other. I'll just start talking, and Madam Chair, on
just 2 seconds.
Oh, okay.
Commissioner Walker.
The issue of that Commissioner Hunter is talking about, namely whether or not the commission should get into whether or not there's an actual legitimate event, and I think that's something we cannot ignore and just say, well, just call it an event and that's it, or to do exactly what you say and automatically it's an event. Because if you get there's all sorts of ways people, as you know, can take issues and say, okay, well, we said, 50 invitations to Abu Dhabi, but only one person can make it there. And so there's all sorts of ways in which we've seen, as we sit here, things come out of the woodwork in a way that you never would have expected. And I don't want to feel like this is, if you use those automatic words and this is what you call them, that there's an automatic safe harbor in all instances. That's something that's my concern.
And Commissioner, my frustration before is I wish you had told me at the beginning you thought this was hypothetical and that I didn't deserve an answer. Because honestly, that's what you're telling me. You're telling me I haven't given you enough facts. I haven't told you where I'm sending the invitations, what the venue is going to be, who's the candidate, and I could have done all that if you had asked. But no one asked me for that. So what I'm asking for, yes, is a safe harbor, not for someone else who's going to read this advisory opinion, not for someone else who's going to misconstrue it, but for Senate Majority PAC and House Majority PAC, which have put facts before you about the event they want to have. You didn't ask for more questions. I mean, with all due respect.
Well, I'm not here to, try and create what you guys want to do.
But if you didn't know.
Information wasn't in there. Let's consider, and I think we're getting a little too far into the weeds, but if you want to say we want to hold on a certain date and this is how many people we're going to invite and here's where the list comes from, would you have a problem with that? And I guess that's where we, is it okay if only two people show up?
Does the First Amendment really require me to come to you every time I hold an event?
No, that's the whole point.
Okay. Well, because I'm here asking an advisory opinion. I submitted it. The General Counsel's office sat on it for 9 days and asked no questions. Zero. It then went to all of you all. You all asked no questions. Then I came to a hearing last week, and no one told me at that hearing, I have a question about what exactly the contours of this event's going to be. So to be honest with you, if and when we wind up in a federal judge, you better have an answer for him about why it is that I wound up at the 8th hour of the second meeting of the 45th day, and at that point the commission was uncertain enough about the facts to answer the question that was presented. It's just terribly disappointing. And on a day where this commission could be celebrating and basking in bipartisanship in solving problems, the idea that the commission has now decided that it will likely deadlock on a central question that we asked because it's a hypothetical, just vote it a hypothetical. Don't spare me that you are disagreeing on the law. What you're saying is you don't have enough facts, and therefore you can't give me an answer, and it's a hypothetical, and we'll see whether a judge believes that a commission can raise the question of a hypothetical at this point in the process. I don't think
Hunter.
It's a hypothetical. I think I asked you a genuine question.
Commissioner Hunter.
Commissioner Walther, is there a room for this second sort of fork in the road that I was trying to describe? Or I'm not hearing that you need more information. I think you said, well, I would take more information if you gave it to me, but I don't. Did you say that you need more information?
What I'm trying to say is that but it doesn't look like we're getting too far along here. Trying to make something work. And of today, we've done pretty well, and in some ways we have not. But what I'm concerned about is where all these steps are taken. Sounds good to me. This is what you want to do, but I want to leave the door open so that we don't get bound up with that word and somebody is using exactly the same scenario in a way that does not really amount to an event. So we were talking earlier about saying otherwise comply with the regulation. Okay.
That's fine.
We were talking about just saying no, but it could be a factor. I see no reason why it should be people should be afraid to recognize it in determining whether or not it otherwise complies with the reg. As a good faith event, factor can't be a factor, can't be a consideration. But I'm not hearing that that's acceptable at this point. So I'm trying to.
I'm fine with it being a factor in other events. People are going to read this and say, in other events, it'll be a factor. But if we follow this, I mean, maybe I should turn it this way. It's not usually my place to ask questions to you, but what other representations do you want about this event to know? You say you need more detail. It seems like you need more detail. What other representations can we put around this event so that we can say unequivocally numerosity doesn't matter?
Well, are you asking us? I mean, here, as I understand it, you only assume that two people are going to attend.
No. I didn't assume two people are going to attend. I asked if we do these things, if we have an invitation, we have remarks, we have disclaimers, we have it at a date certain, on a time certain, in a place that where events are customarily held, if we do all of that, does it matter how many people we invite? If the answer is no, it doesn't matter how many people we invite, then we know we don't have to be mindful of a particular number. If you say yes, it could be a factor. Well, then numerosity does matter, and then we ask, well, is it two? Is it eight? What is it a factor to? Presumably, at 1,000, it's no longer a factor. So, where is it that it, where is that place that we need to know so that when we hold our event, we don't wind up with an FEC complaint and dealing with discovery for Mr. Patelis? Because I can say I got an advisory opinion.
I honestly can't remember what the chair told me with respect to which one you were willing to maybe work with us on. I think you said 12, but I honestly can't remember if it was 11 or 12.
But you didn't agree with it.
Well, would you agree with the language that we've been talking about on question 12? Because it's a little different because we've added all kinds of...
Right. I mean, I have... And I understand your argument, and... I have some of the same concerns. I think if we put in, and I understand that we want to narrow it to the language that you, or to the facts and to the issues that you've set forth. I understand that, and we have, and you've done that. But we do need to. We live in the real world, unfortunately, here of the FEC. And AOs, while they relate to you and your questions, are often interpreted in other ways. And so we do, I believe, have to have some language in it that will ensure that it's understood that it would not be applicable to potential other factors. You and I had this conversation before.
There's good news there because every advisory opinion ends with a paragraph.
Yeah, I know.
That
I
says,
understand. I know that. But nonetheless, we know we have used AOs as precedents in other matters because of language that may not have been narrowly construed. That's my concern, and I not to you know be I'm not at all saying that I'm suspicious of anybody's motives or any of the discussions that we've had here at the table. I just believe that we now have to have language in here that is enough of a constraining language.
So what are you thinking? What kind of language? Because as I said, it already says
we're back.
Such facts or assumptions are material to the conclusion presented in this advisory opinion. If anything changes, then people can't rely on it, and you can only rely on it if they're materially indistinguishable facts. I mean, and that's required by the law.
Yes, but there are other issues that might arise. For example, now he's saying that the request doesn't ask for a particular number, a number of people, or any other possible factors that might, you know, make sense for us to talk about as an issue. I mean, that's part of the concern. I think that we understand that with regard to the question that he's asked, that it is appropriate to say what you want to say, but we don't want any of the consequential decisions that could be made in MERS or in other circumstances that would expand it. That's the problem.
But with all due respect, Madam Chair, you've now turned, it's not me, but it's you who's now turned the AO process into a rulemaking.
No, I haven't turned it into a rulemaking. They are de facto rulemakings at this commission, sadly. Okay. We do not have rulemakings,
and consequently not
very many. And so, consequently, this is how they are interpreted.
So
and as a result of that, I think it's important for us to be extremely cautious about how things are characterized in AO responses. That's just, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to just clarify with my colleague, Commissioner Walther. Are your concerns, are you just clarifying concerns that you don't want a vote for question 12 to be construed in the wrong way and making that part of the public record? We've had the edits about talking about how this is based on and conditioned on the factual representations and the representations regarding compliance with the relevant regulations. Or is your concern that even as proposed in my motion that you've got problems with that as well?
I'm trying to leave open for the future a discussion of if these facts are taken, there could be ways in which it can be abused, and to recognize that fact. And so somebody comes to us and says that we did all these things that the Majority Pact says, but we also only got two people that came, and it turns out really there was only intent to have only two people there, and it was too far away for anybody else to attend, or the ways in which the steps could be warped. I'm wondering at this point, it seems to me we ought to be able to close a gap. We could vote on everything else and leave this open for further discussion to the next meeting.
Past 60 days.
Pardon me?
The next meeting is past 60 days. If I had not been here once before, I would have said, that's fine, but my clients have to move on with their fundraising. We are in the middle of a cycle.
We've got a huge amount done, and it's better to get a possible yes than a clear no right now.
No, it's better. It may not be. It may be better for me to just sue the agency, honestly, and use this record as the basis, because I've now been told by the chair it's a de facto rulemaking. I've been told that we need to qualify and not grant my client an advisory opinion. And I think it's frankly, I can't recommend to my client that they hold this open. I think that it is fair for the agency to say yes. It is fair for the agency to say no. It is fair for the agency to deadlock between yes and no. It is not fair. It is profoundly unfair for me to be here now being told that what you wish to do is to have the ability for my client to do exactly what they asked that they wanted to do and follow it, and then still be subject to enforcement, because you all want the flexibility to have that power. Congress took that away from you. Congress gave me the right to an advisory opinion and gave you the obligation to issue advisory opinions, and you want the flexibility to...
I have to interrupt you here, because I don't think anybody is saying what you're saying. Not anybody is suggesting that your clients, if we agree to an AO in which we say, based on your facts, that that's not going to be a problem, but in other circumstances there may be other factors.
I'm fine
or
with that.
Other
I'm fine with that. In other circumstances.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to
That's what I'm trying to
I'm 100% with you if it's other circumstances.
But also, I mean, I think the problem is, I mean, honestly, the real problem here is that you've not added some things that are important for us to know, such as if there are going to be two people at this event.
When did you ask?
Well,
the general counsel office had 10 days to ask. Did you ask him to ask me? Did they ask me?
It was.
I was here last time. Did you ask me?
Well,
I mean, that's why I'm saying if the commission, what I take the commission is saying, or at least some of the commissioners, the request is a hypothetical. It did not present sufficient facts, and there was a draft that said it was a hypothetical. And I was very clear last time I was here, and I thought it was coming from this side, that if you said it was hypothetical, I was likely going to sue you. And what I'm hearing now is that you are saying that this is a hypothetical, that you do not have sufficient facts to answer the question. And if that's the case, then we will see where my clients decide they want to go with this. But I will just tell you the profound disappointment I have in this agency. As hopeful as I was a few hours ago, I have defended this agency to the press every day. And I just have to say how I wind up sitting here now and being told that I didn't tell you enough facts.
Well,
it's just extraordinary, Madam Chair.
I have your letter dated September 11, 2015, on page 19. And in the question, it says, may Senate contender or House contender appear, speak, or be a featured guest at the event described above if the number of expected attendees is two. So I know in our draft we talked about two.
Did you answer the question that was highlighted?
We answered the question. We said no. Two isn't.
What about question 12? That what's labeled question 12?
I believe in draft.
No. This is page 18. You read from my request, so now I'd like you to point you to my request. Question 12. Does 11 CFR 300.64 require that there be a minimum number of expected attendees before the candidate can permissibly speak, attend, or be featured as a special guest? Have you answered that question?
Well, my first view on this was that we needed to have a rulemaking.
Did the General Counsel's Office tell me that? Did you tell me that? Did anyone
said it in my first draft.
In your first draft. Did I know it was your first draft?
Yes, I said it.
Draft B.
Did I know draft B was your first draft?
Yes, I said it at the meeting.
Not till the meeting?
At the last meeting.
I understand.
So
let's just make our record clear for where we go from here. Your position is if you want a rulemaking, I don't get an advisory opinion.
That's not my position at all. I have done draft B, and I've signed on to draft E, and I've signed on to parts of draft F.
I understand. I said you can have, if you're, in some respects, I understand Commissioner Weintraub's position. It is that she just disagrees with me on the law.
Right.
I totally understand that. I think she's wrong and misguided, but I understand that.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
But what I'm hearing from others on the commission is you may or may not disagree with me on the law. I just haven't provided sufficient facts yet, and you want a little wiggle room to determine whether or not House Majority PAC and Senate Majority PAC can be the subject of future enforcement.
Actually, if I haven't made it very clear, I disagree with you on the law as well.
Okay.
So does that help?
That does help.
Okay. Commissioner Walther.
I'm a little afraid to start talking, but...
you should be.
After the word no, can you just delete that sentence, the first sentence?
Which draft are we?
Just say
draft A, page or just 29.
Say no for the reasons stated below, or something like that.
Are we on page 29 yeah. of draft A?
And then say, although federal candidates generally
yeah,
not.
I'm fine. I've always been fine with just no.
And then get over to page 31.
Got the cause, right?
And we think, Matt, you wrote down some language, and I think it was discussed earlier. In light of requesters' representations that they will comply with all the requirements of 364, comma, together with all any and all other requirements when engaging in the specified activity, blah, blah, blah.
I think.
And then we have, at some point, I do want an understanding that because the number has become a big deal, that the number can be a factor.
Well, given the facts we've laid out.
Not necessarily here, but I mean,
in other cases.
Yeah,
I mean, in other matters.
Yeah, but here's what my concern is: you ask for an opinion, but in a way you're asking for a safe harbor, where.
Exactly, that's what an advisory
opinion is. True, but if you take that skeleton of information, I don't want to get back into all this again. but if you take that skeleton of information and you add a whole bunch of facts in either direction, it could sway totally whether or not this is legitimate or not. That's all. That's all I want to say. I'm not saying about today. But I'm saying that if this could be skewed in a way we don't recognize. So I'm kind of not comfortable using the word safe harbor. Like, this is all you can do it, and you can have it anywhere. You can invite anybody. You can do whatever you want. And the speaker can be a guest speaker that we just invited in the other room, and that kind of thing. So we haven't been faced with these issues much at all in the time I've been here. So it's not like it's a make-or-break deal and people haven't tried to comply with the law. I'm trying to figure out a way to help get it one more step toward a definitive way to handle matters. But I don't think I could give up on the fact that if somebody came and said they ended up having two people there, that's a factor. It's not dispositive. And I'm more than willing to say that, too. In other words, it's a factor, but not dispositive. Something along that line. And I don't think it's unreasonable to recognize that we have to look at whether or not somebody had a fundraising event in good faith. And I don't want to get into the situation that Commissioner Hunter is concerned about, but sometimes we find ourselves in situations whether we like it or not. So. Do you have any thoughts on how to get through this thing?
It may be that the commissioners should, I don't know if any of the other commissioners have thoughts.
Well, I would just,
Commissioner,
just seeking clarification that when you say that that should remain a factor, I think you're saying that should be a factor when, as we consider this in light of other facts,
yeah.
Under factual scenarios, possibly by other requesters or other actors other than this. If I understand you correctly, and if I'm not, then clarify. And I've said, hopefully I'm not completely repeating myself, but I think we want to give this requester, I hope we want to give this requester an answer while trying to confine the reasoning in a way so that, while my kids are still young. But also do so in a way that we're not crafting a precedent that you think could be abused. And that I think that that's what this exercise has been about, is trying to cabinet to these facts so that this requester, as presented by the facts that are in his request and as he's represented information to us during the course of these many hours, that he can take comfort from an advisory opinion, but that we still, if we're given different facts in a different scenario from either a different requester or a different a respondent, that this is a narrowly tailored advisory opinion is what again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I
think you're capturing, the concern I have, and it's got to be a way to make this work and let you get out the door without throwing your file at us.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm going to try, framing it this way. I think what Mr. Elias is asking for is, do numbers matter? Given everything that he has told us, assume that, there's going to be the invitation of the formal program, blah, 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 all the things that he laid out in his request, and two people show up, would you be comfortable with that? If you would, then you should say yes. You should join with the Republican commissioners and say yes. If you wouldn't...
Actually say no.
Sorry. Say yes to what he wants to do.
It was
say,
a trick by her.
No, yes, no, I didn't. Sorry.
I'm just kidding.
No. I wasn't trying to. But if that makes a difference to you, then numbers do matter. I mean, they matter to me. I said that at the outset. But, if that would make a difference to you, then, as I said before, I don't think there actually is a meeting of the minds. And I do want to say one thing on one other point. I understand your frustration, Mr. Elias. We're all a little bit tired, hot, frustrated, and cranky at the end of the day. But I want to make one point. You have repeatedly, here today and on Twitter and in Publix, suggested that our Office of General Counsel has sat on your requests for an impermissibly long period of time. Statute provides that we have 10 days to review a request before we make it public, and that gives us, and it's you asked a complicated question, and it took our staff a few days to go through it and make sure that they felt comfortable that they had all the information they wanted, and we posted it to the website 7 calendar days after it was received. And for you to repeatedly imply that our staff was negligent in dealing with your request or dragged their feet on it in any way, I think, is completely unfair. And they're not going to take to Twitter to respond to that, so I wanted to respond to that publicly. They were within all the timelines. You can complain about us, about our not being more forthcoming with you at the last meeting or our sitting here all day long and then perhaps not resolving the question. Fair game. I'll take that criticism, but I really think that it was untoward of you to criticize the staff in that way.
Well, and I'd like to respond if I may.
Sure. Just a minute.
Go ahead with your dialogue.
Give us 5 minutes.
All right, go ahead, respond.
Okay.
They don't have to listen.
That's fine. First of all, I asked for expedited treatment of this matter within 30 days, which is pursuant to a policy that the commission adopted.
I get it, but it was a complicated series of 12 questions, and we were not capable of doing that.
Okay. So, first of all, I asked for it to be expedited and handled in 30 days because it was sensitive, and in case you haven't noticed, there is a lot of super PAC activity going on out there. I noted publicly, and I'm happy to note here, that the General Counsel's office has 10 days, and they were prepared to take as much of it as they needed, which was a lot of it. And during that time period, they did not ask me a single follow-up question. Now, I submit a lot of advisory opinion requests, and I get a lot of follow-up questions. I get a lot of follow-up questions that I actually complain that I get follow-up questions about because I ask, how could it possibly be relevant? In this instance, what I wanted to make sure was that 45 days later, I wasn't sitting at an FEC hearing being told that the commission didn't have all of the facts they needed. So when I didn't hear from the commission, from the general counsel's office, I was surprised, given the complexity of the issues. I was surprised, given the complexity of the facts underlying it, and I did not want to wind up in a circumstance in which the request was not being granted because it was deemed to be hypothetical. I never disparaged the staff. I think I've actually been quite complimentary to the staff today. I think their draft was excellent. Would I have wished that the General Counsel's office had posted a draft quicker? Yes. I think, in general, the federal government should move as expeditiously as possible on all things that involve customer service. And I'm a taxpayer. I represent taxpayers. I represent regulated parties before this agency. And they have a right to expect that if they submit a request, that they will get things treated as promptly and expeditiously as possible. and not hearing back from the General Counsel's office did leave me to question whether or not it was being processed as quickly as possible. The language that I used about sitting on it was language I used today, and I used it today because it is inconceivable to me. Somehow, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in this agency to understand how no questions were generated during that time period, and yet there are so many questions today by the commissioners. Because I get questions from the General Counsel's office.
Then you should blame the commissioners, not the staff.
I didn't blame the staff. I'm happy to blame the commissioners. I'm just saying that I routinely get follow-up questions, and in this instance, I didn't. And it has
you should be gratified by that.
I was until today, at which point I'm being told that you don't have all the facts necessary. You do. It's not aimed at you, Commissioner Weintraub.
No, I get it.
But that there are others who wish that they had more facts so that they could more directly cabin or know what it is they're weighing in on. And it will surprise you to say I actually don't disagree entirely with the way in which you frame this. I mean, I disagree with you on the law, but in terms of...
You don't like my answer, but you don't disagree with the question.
So I hope that answers it. I didn't mean disrespect to the staff. I didn't mean to suggest that they violated their duty. I did think that the general public would have been better served if they had an answer within 30 days. I know it's complex, but there are a few things that this agency right now is confronted with that it should be more pressing than questions that involve super PAC activity. So, yes, I will not back down a minute and say that I think the agency dealt with the text messaging AO last cycle by the phone companies, where it was a totally novel question. Like completely novel. It was whether or not you could accept donations via text message. I think they did that in 20 days. And that was where there was not a shred of regulatory fiber to work with, other than sheer analogies of anonymous contributions and this and that. And they did it because I think the agency determined that in the heat of a presidential campaign, when presidential candidates wanted to raise text money, it was a priority of the agency to move heaven and earth. They clearly didn't view this advisory opinion in that same category.
I disagree with that.
That's okay. That's their prerogative. I'm just saying I can be critical of that, though.
No, it's the commissioners. You know, the staff came up with one draft. It was the commissioners who came up with another five drafts.
And I have complimented that draft.
Yes, you have. and I'm sure the staff appreciates that. But again, you know, you. I yield to no one in my desire for timely action by this commission, but you cannot expect an instant answer to a complicated question, and I think that this in many ways presents more complicated questions for the commission than the text messaging AI.
That's fine. I will add only, and since I feel like at this point we're just talking while they're talking.
Right. So that's
the other thing I would add is that if you go back and look at what I said on Twitter at the time, is I was upset that it was not posted.
Yeah.
I do not understand why the agency cannot more timely post materials.
Because the staff was going through it and considering whether they needed to ask you some questions. That's not an instantaneous decision.
Yeah, so,
and they ultimately decided, no, it was okay.
So this may very well be a moment where perhaps we'll have agreement, perhaps we'll have disagreement. I'm glad the chair is listening to this. I sat in that seat when John Kerry's presidential audit was here, unable to answer questions that the commissioners had about the nature of questions in that process. I'm sorry, in an advisory opinion, not it wasn't the audit, it was an advisory opinion about the way in which the Kerry campaign paid for media. And I couldn't answer questions. And as a result, there was a change in process of how AOs are handled. And I might suggest to the commission that it consider that materials get posted instantaneously. They are, after all, FOIA-able. Right, whether that document was accepted or rejected or it's FOIA-able. So why doesn't the agency that is committed to disclosure say, when you file something with our agency, we just post it. It's out there in the world. And then if our lawyers need to ask follow-up questions, they ask follow-up questions. But that document is public. And that's what I was irritated about. What I was expressing was not how long they were taking to answer the question. At that point, I had no idea how long they'd take. But if you look carefully, what I was saying is, why isn't it posted? Why isn't it posted? Why doesn't the public who has read about this request in the New York Times, why can't they actually see the request on the website? So it was actually a pro-disclosure concern I had.
Well, I think that you raise an interesting, that would be a change in our procedure. As you know, by long, long, long tradition, what we do is we make sure the request is complete. And, you know, that maybe we should consider doing it. I will think about it. I think it's an interesting suggestion. You could post it on your website, Mr. Elias. Nothing was stopping you.
I tried to figure this out yesterday.
I think it's worthy. We're discussing different ways of disclosing more documents, and I personally like your idea. We'll discuss it with counsel.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
And then if we need to ask you more questions and have you amend it, then I guess we can do that.
And let me go back, because I understand when I was talking to another commissioner that I missed some of the things that you were saying about us not actually wanting to respond to your questions, which we do. There is no question that we do. And the issue is, as I said, I mean, you had a statement about the number. The number is important, in my view.
I understand that.
That's the problem. It's not that we do not want to provide you guidance. It's not that we want to create a problem for you in compliance at all. And you're entitled to an answer.
Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you.
So,
and I appreciate that.
So to the extent that we can, I mean, here, there's obviously, this is the most unusual AO so far in my tenure.
I think I've done 50 AOs. I think this is actually my 50th.
Not unusual?
And this is the most unusual AO for me as well.
Commissioner Hunter, I was going to make a suggestion, but go ahead.
Question 12, if he does deserve an answer, what is your answer?
I mean, am I missing something?
Yeah, no.
No.
I think there's still conversations taking place about this. So,
I'm losing my co-counsel.
What I am suggesting, there's a number of AOs that we still have.
If you'd like to take your tie and jacket off.
Since I didn't come with a tie, my penance is to wear a jacket.
We don't mind. It's okay.
I left it in the office.
So you want to wait to see how this sidebar goes? Because it didn't sound like you were in play even, but maybe you are. Okay.
So,
what are we doing?
I have no idea.
Why don't we take a brief recess, just to satisfy the Secretary's concerns about the status we're in.
So we can take a brief recess. Let's also talk about... Is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because my motion isn't convoluted enough, I will further refine my motion with respect to question 12 and do so... as follows.
Can I ask one question? Are we on draft A?
We are working from draft A. Yes.
Being serious.
So we're going to import from draft A.
Thank you.
And insert it into draft F.
Thank you.
Okay.
Could I also mention, I understand that Mr. Lowenstein is on the phone, or is it Mr. Bates?
Both of them are on the phone.
Are they both on this phone? I am so sorry to both of you.
They can't hear you right now. They're in the queue waiting
for
their request.
But you can still be sorry.
I am really sorry, but I'm sorry for a number of reasons. But is there anyone who can communicate to them?
Jim Jones can tell them.
That we will try to deal with this matter immediately after this. Well, I know Mr. Reese is here too, but okay.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. Oh, and just for the sake of clarification of the record, during the recess, I spoke with Mr. Elias about the proposed motion, just so there's no ex parte issues or anything, or that they're fully disclosed. I just wanted to explain what we were doing. So on page 29 of draft A, we will be inserting the analysis with respect to question 12, but with the following modifications. The paragraph from lines 8 through 10 we will remove so that the answer will begin with, although federal candidates generally may not solicit non-federal funds, etc. The next edit is on page 30. On line 10, there is a footnote 15 in the text to the footnote at the bottom of the page. Delete that and instead insert, as explained above, the commission could not agree whether the single candidate committees would be permitted to raise non-federal funds, period.
Isn't that where you were putting the parenthetical?
What's that?
Isn't that where you were putting the parenthetical?
We put the I think we put the parenthetical earlier, but we could, if needs be, we could also put.
There was put that in the technical or whatever you guys ask.
Yeah.
Conforming it.
Then on page 31, the sentence beginning with "although requesters propose," mm-hmm. we are going to strike that entire sentence. In the next sentence, we are going to strike "thus" and the comma, so that this paragraph, and then capitalize "in," so that it will now read, "in light of requesters' factual representations and their representations that they will comply with all of the requirements of 11 CFR section 300.64 and any other applicable commission regulation when engaging in the specified activity, comma, a federal candidate may attend, speak, or be a featured guest as proposed," period.
I think the intent of that was the requesters.
Can you repeat the last phrase, "and any other commission or regulation"?
Yeah, and any other applicable commission regulation.
Okay. Okay. All right.
It's a stripped down answer, but it is an answer. So,
Madam Secretary, is that, do you have that?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Walt, so going back to after the reference to 11 CFR section 300.64.
Which one?
Oh, I'm sorry, on line 6 of page 31. This is kind of in the catch-all. And let it, I'm trying to think of what's the requirements of 11 CFR 300.64 and any other requirement under the Act or applicable commission regulations. Commissioner Walther proposed that we also bring in the statute. So it's kind of a catch-all. Does that make sense, Madam Secretary?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Is that clear to everybody? Okay, comments, questions with regard to that? All right, ready for a vote on the motion. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No. All right, Madam Secretary, that motion passes by a vote of 4-2 with Commissioner Goodman, Commissioner Hunter, Vice Chair Peterson, and Commissioner Walther voting yes. Oh, is there? Let me finish the and
two votes no, Commissioner Weintraub and myself. Mr. Noddy.
Madam Chair, today is the deadline, the statutory deadline, to send this AO to the requester. Given the time and the fact that it needs to be prepared and signed by yourself and sent, I was wondering if commissioners might kindly ask Mr. Elias if he would give us a day or two. Tomorrow's a holiday, a day or two to complete that process.
When do you need until?
You think by Friday?
That would be great.
That's fine.
Is Friday good?
Yeah.
Yeah. You are?
Commissioner Walther also asked that we circulate this informationally so that we can actually see all of this in a draft.
Certainly. When we send it to the chair for her signature, we can send it to everybody. Yeah. Is that,
that
what you're envisioning?
That would be great.
Don't worry.
You read my mind.
Yeah. Okay. Anything further on this matter?
I would only ask, Mr. Noddy, do you have the sufficient authority to make any technical and conforming edits that you may need?
We don't need to ask anymore. The commission
has
approved that.
I just wanted to make sure that was properly on the books.
They always have it. Thank you very much.